Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is October 26, 2013, and this is episode 39, Werewolf Bar Mitzvah.
Spooky scary!
Welcome again, boys and ghouls, to another episode of Game Buoy in the Spirit of Season. This, of course, references Halloween, not Christmas, just so we're clear. This week we're going to be looking at a handful of our favorite ghoulish greats and exploring a few moldy oldies that maybe you missed. But before we get to the discussion, we have a pretty full slate of our usual follow-ups and news bits. In the interest of your time and our own, let's get this party started.
Would you like to take the first one because it's Kingdom Hearts?
As a matter of fact, I would. In between this episode and our last, a new trailer for Kingdom Hearts 3 hit. So yeah, at the D23 Expo, held in Tokyo this year, a special Kingdom Hearts limited stage event was held at the Mai Hama Amphitheater in the Tokyo Disney Resort. During the event, Square Enix shared some information on Kingdom Hearts 3 that we would like to talk about here on the show. Of course, while the trailer that we've seen so far only had Sora in it, you know, using some new Keyblade techniques, using a new movement system called Attraction Flow. You know, Riku is also going to be making a return. Sora and Riku are going to have new outfits. Since then, some news has trickled out, you know, and then later on that week, doing press for Kingdom Hearts 3, Tetsuya Nomura also teased the return of series mainstays Roxas and Ventus. And further in addition, you know, he sort of detailed the Attraction Flow, which again we have seen in the really quite impressive new trailer that I've mentioned here. In addition to that, also present in that trailer is the ability for Sora to change his Keyblades into different weapons. You may recall, of course, Slagkick from this trailer that just hit this teaser, at one point the Keyblade becomes a set of guns that Sora is dual-wielding.
Yes. I was a little surprised, because Disney.
Yeah, me too, especially when you look at some of the earlier games, Kingdom Hearts 2 and Birth by Sleep in particular, where, you know, they were editing out guns that were, you know, very specifically very gun-like, turning them into crossbows or what have you. So, I was very surprised by this change. In addition, Kingdom Hearts HD 2.5 Remix has been officially confirmed. You know, obviously, if you're interested in these sorts of games, you've already heard this, even though it happens strictly between episodes of Game Buoy. You've got to know that this is on the horizon. And as we've previously discussed, per that Kingdom Hearts 1.5 HD Remix teaser towards the end of the game, the games contained are Kingdom Hearts 2 Final Mix, Birth by Sleep Final Mix, and remastered cinematics from Kingdom Hearts Recoded.
Is that what you had predicted for the cinematics, or was it from a different game?
That was exactly what we had discussed previously, yeah.
That's what I thought.
So, you know, and it's already been confirmed for a U.S. release. That is, to me, the most exciting part of this. There won't be any of this wait-and-see stuff. We're finally going to get Kingdom Hearts 2's Final Mix. Which, as far as fans of the series are concerned, that's sort of the highlight of the entire franchise from a gameplay perspective, so that's very exciting.
Indeed.
Slagkick, would you like to take this next news story and move us out of Kingdom Hearts territory?
Yes. Well, it's still Square Enix-related, kind of, because there is going to be a Dragon Quest Metal Slime smartphone running Android released in Japan by Docomo, who we talked about last time. It's
to the Docomo.
Let's not start that again, but
I'll have you know, I got several tweets about that.
I didn't get any tweets.
They were private.
Oh. Well, anyways, if you are in Japan and interested in having a Dragon Quest smartphone, it is a Sharp smartphone running Android 4.2. I don't know what that is, like ice cream sandwich or jelly bean or...
truly haven't the foggiest.
I don't even know what... Are they on K yet? Is it like Kale or something?
Wait, oh, do they go alphabetically?
They do, yeah.
I had no idea. Oh, wasn't it Kit Kat?
Is it?
I feel like there was some...
I don't know, it's Android, I don't really care, but...
yeah, I feel like there was some amount of controversy that they were going with the name brand.
It's 5-inch display, 1080p, Full HD screen, TFT LCD. That's a good thing, right?
I think so.
That's like what the Galaxy has. And 15 megapixel camera, outer camera. And supports NFC, and it has Dragon Quest VII Journey of the Cursed King pre-installed. So that's cool, but I don't know. Android, and also it's Japan only. And we're not phone buoy, so let's move on.
So you may recall a few weeks back we were discussing the many purchasing options. I'm sorry, I'm trying to think of a way to say this. I was going to say retail configurations, but I guess that's not really appropriate terminology for a download title. Except, we now have a retail purchase option for Killer Instinct. This is, of course, the Xbox One launch title fighting game revival of the classic Rare fighting game series.
That's so funny to hear the words Rare and Classic in the same sentence.
Okay, let's be real. Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah, I just mean...
GoldenEye.
I just mean these
Jet days. Force Gemini.
I just mean that I haven't heard
Banjo-Tooie.
The two words combined. Oh, just go on.
Blast Core.
Just go on with it.
So, you know, we've discussed that there's going to be, you know, the free option with individual characters purchased. There's the $20 all characters option, the $40 all characters and some bonuses, and the original game option. There's now the pin ultimate option. And this is going to be a set of, you know, the game as well as a set of the quote, and I'm doing a little air quotes right now, Penny Arcade pins. You're shaking your head.
You can't see it because this is a podcast, but I was shaking my head like Captain Spike just said. I have attitude about Penny Arcade. I think it's pretty LOL. And I'm just like, leave the pin trading to Disney. Thanks.
Well, you know, they very specifically said that they were getting into pin trading in Penny Arcade because they enjoyed this sort of meta game at Disneyland so much. And they very specifically wanted to bring this sort of thing to their convention space.
Yeah, well, the Penny Arcade guys are transphobic assholes, so fuck them.
Strictly speaking, I don't disagree with you. In fact, I do agree. This is a fact, and it gets really hard to support anything these guys do.
But if you're into Penny Arcade and you're planning to get an Xbox One, which is maybe one listener...
You know, I have to admit, for all of this shade we're throwing, I'm... sort of beginning to consider day one-ing an Xbox One. And if I do, I'll almost certainly buy this Killer Instinct pin Ultimate Edition.
Well, have fun recording the first Game Buoy where I don't appear on it.
You would leave the show over me buying a console.
No, I just mean I wouldn't appear on that episode.
You wouldn't appear on the episode we recorded the week I got the console. Oh, are you assuming we'd do an episode about the console?
So, we talked about JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
So this set will
Are you still talking about Penny Arcade?
This set is going to come with a case for the 16-pin set designed by the Penny Arcade guys. It's going to come with the season pass for all costumes.
Oh, so you mean it's going to be the same old tired art style, then?
Season pass for all costumes, accessories, and characters. And, yeah, it's going to be like buying the Ultra Edition with Jago pin and a logo pin. And then the rest you'll have to get at Penny Arcade events through the Penny Arcade trading at booths and what have you. So if you're into pins, you're into Killer Instinct, like Sly Kick said, that's where it is for you.
Yeah, I'm probably going to get some Twitter hate. I just feel it. I don't know.
But you were saying JoJo.
JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is going to be... I'm sorry, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure All-Star Battle is going to have some name changes... Because there are some characters named Devo and Vanilla Ice, and they had to be named Debo and Iced because of copyright issues.
Now, for those of you who have been interested in fighting games for a long time, you may recall Capcom made a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure fighting game for the Dreamcast, as well as the CPS 3, and then it was backported to the CPS 2 arcade hardwares. And they made very similar changes. I think they even used the same name changes as All-Star Battle will be using. So there is precedent for it. I think it's very interesting. And, you know, all of the characters in JoJo well, not all, but most of them are references to bands and musicians, which is what, you know, made Slagkick giggle. But I sort of expected that they'd have to change some of these names. Like, I think there's a character named Foreigner.
I'm just laughing because I'm like, too bad it wasn't Journey. I'm sorry, I'm just like so controversial this episode, but I always thought of Foreigner as like a second-rate Journey. If you take issue with this, sorry, go cry about it. So something else that's kind of interesting is that Japanese sound effects and Japanese voice acting will also be retained in the U.S. version. And I guess I'm not familiar with JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, but apparently, like, the Japanese sound effects are part of the manga even when it's localized.
Yes.
So I guess it's, you know, just to keep the flavor of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure.
And I just want to point out one of my very favorite names from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. That would be Robert Edward O. Speedwagon. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting that they're keeping the all of the Kana sound effects and stuff in. Like, first off, that's going to be a hell of a look. Like, I think that it's going to look really great. And, you know, further, just, like, what a great way to retain the original appeal of the graphic design. I'm really excited for this game.
Yeah, it looks fun.
Next up on the list, we have news that Disgaea 4 Return. This, of course, is the Disgaea 4 PlayStation Vita Enhanced version, will include a new story episode with the character Sister Artina. This was, of course, a nun in the original game, and Famitsu reports that it is going to be sort of that scene.
Cool.
Which one has to assume probably has some... You know what? I'm not going to make assumptions. Please look forward to it. Hopefully this game is going to come out to the U.S. and you will be able to look forward to it. We still haven't heard anything, which for this franchise I think is very strange. We typically do get these games released here, even like the weird like spin-off visual novels.
And so, like the pretty side games.
Yeah, which are pretty fun, I think.
Operation, like, Liberate My Panties, Dude? What was it called?
I think it's just Operation Panties, Dude.
It's something about panties. There's something about panties. So, do you have anything else to say about...
No. Okay. Just that I hope it comes out here.
Yeah, I mean, you know...
I know we know people at Nippon Ichi. Let's hope word goes on.
Yeah. So, you like worms, right? The game, not like... like.
I was like, what, you think I'm like dragging my butt across the floor? Like
You like the game Worms, right?
I like gummy worms too, but yes I do. I like the game
and
Worms
a
lot.
You like Terraria quite a bit, don't you?
I love Terraria.
Well then you're gonna love this follow up because Worms 3, which as you know is the iOS exclusive latest iteration in the Worms franchise.
Boo. I'm booing iOS exclusive, okay?
We'll be adding Terraria content. Well actually has added Terraria content, and also slashed its price for a limited time to 99 cents. So, I know you're all boo-hiss about...
But I'm also literally right this very moment loading up Worms 3 on the App Store.
Yeah. So, there's also some Halloween items as well, and bug
Halloween!
Fixes. But I think some of the...
Sounds spoopy.
I think some of the Terraria themes are going to be really fun to include, so...
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm downloading Worms 3 right now.
Cool, I should do that too.
Why don't you download that while I take this next story? You may recall in Pokemon XY, which is out now, if you've been around on the internet during the last week, you've probably heard about how
I'd say it Lumios, but I'm probably butchering the French. Lumiole City. I'm gonna get hate tweets for that.
Yeah, well, you're doing a racist, nationalist caricature voice, so you deserve it.
The sad thing is it's not the first time that I've done that on Game Boy. Sorry.
That is sad. You know, there's a bug that if you save in the main circle of the city, that you will, you know, your game will crash, you'll freeze up, and, you know, obviously you'll have problems loading your save when you try to come back to it. There is now a patch for this bug. So if you're listening to this and you're someone who's playing Pokemon XY, Run, don't walk, to the Nintendo eShop right now. You can download this patch. It's like 900 blocks or whatever, and it should get your set right. It apparently also has some fixes for some connectivity issues people were suffering using the global trading system, as well as some O-Power stuff, so...
Does it solve people sending me crappy Pokemon in a Wonder Trade?
I assume not. That's a player problem. And hey, I say that as someone who has gotten more Flabébés over Wonder Trade than I think there exist Flabébés in Kalos.
What you got a problem with Flabébé for, huh?
Flabébé kids!
See, I keep getting, what is the first version of Spewpa and Vivillon? It's like Scatterbug. I keep getting like level 2 Scatterbugs. And I traded like a level 23 Wobbuffet. I'm kind of getting into what's up territory, so let's move on.
Final Fantasy XIV, A Realm Reborn, has over 1.5 million registered accounts.
Oh, remember when the Old Republic had that type of subscriber numbers?
Aww, yeah, it feels like a really long time ago. You know, this isn't news. As I've talked about, every time I play Final Fantasy XIV, and I am a paying subscriber, I just haven't had a lot of time for it recently, but I still try to log in once a week. Every time I talk about it, I remark on the fact that this is like my favorite MMO, and that holds true even still. So I'm not surprised that people are flocking to this game, that I think it has fairly good word of mouth. You know, hopefully all of these people stay on and keep, you know, playing, keep paying. As we saw from Final Fantasy XI, you can have a lot fewer subscribers than 1.5 million and end up being very profitable. I think it would be very good for Final Fantasy XIV as an individual game, as well as Square Enix and the Final Fantasy franchise as a whole, for this game to continue doing well. So hopefully they'll keep supporting the game, they'll get some really good, meaningful add-on content, and, you know, hopefully things will go swimmingly.
Yeah, I mean, like, considering where the game was a year ago, you know...
Absolutely.
It's doing pretty well.
Absolutely.
I think people... I'm glad to see that people are receiving the new content well in the makeover, because... You know, if I had more time, I'd probably be playing it and a better gaming PC.
We'll get there. You'll get there. you know, we've talked previously about the announcement of Ultra Street Fighter 4, and I'm sorry to cut you off here, but this is obviously one that I want to take. They've added a couple of new gameplay systems. The first is the Ultra Combo Double. You may recall in previous iterations of Street Fighter 4 that you would have to choose what Ultra Combo you were going to use before the beginning of a match, much in the same way that you would do in Street Fighter 3. The Ultra Combo Double system allows you to pick an option, a third option, which will let you do either of your Ultra Combos, but when you use them, it will be at a reduced damage output rate. So it's like you'll get access to both your Shinku Haruken and your, whatever the Super Shoryuken is called. But they'll both do less damage than they would if you were only had access to one. From a balance perspective, I think this makes a lot of sense. You know, you're getting more tools in your box, but resultantly these tools are a little less effective.
You would like more tools in your box, wouldn't
you? Girl. The second mechanic is called the Red Focus Attack. And it will strengthen your focus attack at the cost of super meter, but will be like an even more powerful version of the focus attack that, you know, absorbs multiple attacks. And you know, obviously, so then like a red focus Hadouken would go through multiple other Hadoukens that someone was throwing at you. Like, just from a pure gameplay perspective, it's like an option to sort of supercharge even more than you could with your regular focus attacks.
Delightful. So we have some J-Star...
You see why I wanted to take that.
Yeah, because you probably were able to explain it much better than I would have been able to. We've talked a lot about J-Star's Victory Versus, which is, of course, the upcoming Namco Bandai crossover fighting game, in much in the Shonen Jump All-Stars, or I forget the exact title, but you know, we've talked about it a lot. So there's going to be two versions. One's going to be the regular
Jump
version.
Jump Superstars and Jump Ultimate Stars.
Thank you. I knew there was Jump and Stars, but I couldn't remember what else. So there's going to be the regular versions for PS3 and Vita, but then there's also going to be J-Star's Victory Versus Anime Sound Edition, which will include 21 anime theme songs as background music. It'll be a little pricier, but I think worth it, because I want to be able to battle while listening to Cha-La Head Cha-La.
Well, and to put this in perspective, the regular versions are going to be $80 and $70 respectively, which are normal prices for games in Japan. And the anime sound editions are going to be $110 and $100, again, respectively. And what this tells me is that you're basically paying separate for, like, the song rights licensing. And what's really interesting to me about this is that, you know, the Jump Superstars and Jump Ultimate Stars, you know, fantastic games. Genbarian, who developed them with Nintendo, really outdid themselves. But one thing that got a lot of complaints was the sort of generic presentation, the lack of you know, like, meaningfully used, like, soundtrack cues. Like, it was all very generic music. I think it's very interesting that they're doing a separate version of the game, again, at a higher cost to compensate presumably for the rights licensing, to the authentic anime music to really circumvent that and make the game feel more, based on this, you know, sort of these Jump Universe anime characters.
Indeed. And I just hope that we'll be able to have this when it, I mean, I'm optimistic about it getting localized just because.
One concern I have is that the localized version will probably not have an option for the anime music. Unless, you know, maybe as downloadable content, I'd pay $30 for, you know, a complete soundtrack, including such hits as Chala, Head Chala.
Yeah, it would be interesting if it was like, oh, you can also listen to it just as a musical playlist.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because just last week, Namco Europe registered web domains for One Piece Red, which, of course, is the One Piece Monster Hunter clone that we've discussed quite a bit here on Game Buoy. So that's pretty good. In addition, they registered a domain for something called Awakened Legends Versus, which a lot of people are speculating could very well be J-Star's Victory Versus.
I guess that's true, because I guess J-Star's really wouldn't have much relevance in a Western market.
No, I don't think
unless
that
you're
would.
A Game Buoy listener.
I am a little surprised that they wouldn't go for the Shonen Jump branding here in the U.S. and just call it, you know,
Jump Stars Victory.
Shonen Jump Legends Versus. That, to me, would be the name in the U.S., but then I considered some of these properties that in Japan are Jump properties could be licensed by different companies here. And who's to say that you wouldn't have Funimation or someone protesting the use of these characters that they have licensed here in the U.S. under, you know, a specific brand that they don't own. It seems silly, but, you know, rights issues are weird like that. And maybe there's some other reason for it to be called Awakened Legends Versus. But this still, again, sounds to me like J-Star's Victory Versus, and I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. Though, you know, it does occur that since, you know, PlayStation 3 region-free, maybe it won't matter and I'll just import anyway. In other news, we have confirmation that in early 2014, Ragnarok Odyssey Ace will be coming to the U.S. for PlayStation 3 and Vita. This is going to cost $40 for either version and include all DLC released for the original game. Launch copies of the Vita version will also contain extra loot in the form of a 25-song soundtrack.
Nice. In other awesome news that is happening in early 2014, Tales of Symphonia Chronicles will be coming to North America. It's on February 25th, 2014. So Tales of Symphonia Chronicles, of course, includes the HD versions of Tales of Symphonia and the Wii sequel Tales of Symphonia Dawn of the New World. For some reason, Symphonia is a difficult word for me to say. but, yeah, so that's good news. You know, I was reading over on Silicon Era that the Tales team staff isn't large enough to be localizing every single game, so that's good that we're getting Tales of Symphonia Chronicles.
Well, of course, it's, you know, it's not that surprising since the localization in many ways was already done. These games have come to the U.S. previously. I'm excited just to see them. You know, I played the original Symphonia for GameCube. It was my first real Tales experience. I never got around to Dawn of the New World, so that's exciting to me.
I mean, Tales of Symphonia is one of the, like, most classic, beloved Tales games, isn't it?
I think especially in the U.S., it's well known because in the U.S., that was sort of the start of it really getting pushed here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, also interesting is that the Chronicles collection is going to have both the GameCube and the PS2 opening themes for Tales of Symphonia.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, that's exciting. That's a neat little bonus for fans of the series.
Great.
I have no real interest in talking about this. I know you will. Please take it.
Well, it's about game difficulty, so you might be a little interested. Eiji Onuma-san was talking with the German gaming site GameWelt, and he was talking about how when you finish your first playthrough of A Link Between Worlds, you'll unlock a higher difficulty level. There's no real details about it. I mean, it's not too surprising to me. I mean, Master Quest, Second Quest, so... I mean, exactly what will change is still, you know, remains to be seen.
You know, something else interesting about that interview is that Aonoma-san also discusses how over 90 staff members worked on A Link Between Worlds. And while we look at the way that a lot of Western studios staff, and, you know, even like a fairly modest team in a Western studio would be, you know, something like 70 to 80 people, 90 for a Nintendo game, that's actually quite a lot, especially for a 3DS game. So this, in Nintendo terms, is a huge undertaking.
Well, it's in their best interest to have this game do well, because, I mean, it's tied in with the beloved A Link to the Past, and, you know, I think they really need to build up momentum for Zelda U, so...
Ugh. I think we'd all just be a lot better if they just put the old one down and just let it go forever.
One of these days we're going to have a Zelda episode and you're going to have to come clean on all this.
What do you mean come clean? You make me sound like Hillary Duff.
Let the rain fall down. Alright.
So we also have news that the really incredible Link Between Worlds 3DS XL, you may be familiar, of course, it has sort of etchings of that really beautiful insignia for Link Between Worlds of the Golden Triforce and the Dark Triforce on, you know, sort of the two-toned color palette of the 3DS's plastic casing, where, like, the top side is golden with the Triforce etching and the bottom is black with the Triforce etching. Apparently, this unit is going to be coming to the U.S. Black Friday weekend, according to GameStop's leaked Black Friday ad.
God, I mean, like, I keep telling myself that I don't need this because I have a 3DS XL, but it's so beautiful. And I keep telling myself that I'm, like, should save my money for other things, but it's so beautiful.
And last, but most certainly not least...
It is so beautiful.
It is rather pretty. And it also, this bundle will also come with the game, so that's exciting.
You sounded quite impressed with it for someone who doesn't care for the Zelda franchise.
Yeah, well, I can recognize beauty, and that's a beautiful 3DS. I'm not into girls, but I can appreciate pretty women.
Okay, so tell us about the Stanley Parable.
Pretty women. Yeah, so, you know, we talked here a little bit last week about the Stanley Parable, this really incredible metagame game. I'm a Pokemon named Metagame.
Metagame! Is that like a Metapod?
Yeah, right? I'm gonna become a Butterfree. A game for IDK. I lost the plot. So, this game, it's really incredible, but a lot of people notice that one point towards the beginning of the game, there's some really fairly offensive content in the form of some slides that are presented to you as a player. In, like, the form of a PSA video in-game. I recognize and appreciate the place of privilege that a humor writer could come to this material and think it's very funny. It's sort of making jokes about impoverished children in third world countries. But, you know, there's been some outcry on the internet about how problematic this content is. And the devs have taken a step back, having been called out on it, and have, you know, agreed and said that they're going to remove this content from the game. They're going to patch it out.
Well, that's good.
So, I'm excited for this. I think the game's absolutely a great experience and totally worth playing. And I'm really happy that they're going to remove this offensive content, because, you know, that's going to make more people more comfortable playing it and having this really cool experience. You don't have anything to say about that.
Yes, it's nice to see developers taking responsibility when, you know, content's offensive instead of just continuing to sell bloody torsos.
All right, well, with that, now it's time for...
News. 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 Oh my god, news.
Oh my god, news.
Oh, I thought you said you were going to take this one. So Dragon Ball Z Battle of Z is going to be coming out in North America on January 28th of next year for 360, PS3, and Vita. The Vita will be download only, but the others will be available at retail.
Excellent. You know, that's very exciting. I don't know if we've talked too much about Battle of Z here on the show, but I'm really surprised by all of these sort of late-generation anime games that Namco Bandai are producing. And furthermore, how many they're bringing here to the U.S.
Well, it seems to be a trend in this episode.
Indeed. Well, you know, that's sort of why I saw all of these stories and was like, you know, there's a theme here. Like, with this announcement, we already know that JoJo's coming to the U.S. Now we have indication that the One Piece Red is coming out. We have indication that we may be getting J-Stars Victory Versus. This is an exciting time for anime fans who are also gamers in the U.S.
Indeed.
Next up, we have news that Skylanders Swap Force is getting a Wii U bundle here in North America in November. Obviously, it looks to me like Activision is trying to cash in on that Black Friday money. This is going to be available starting November 15th for $300. Oh, interesting. That's the same day that the PS4 comes out.
Oh, interesting.
So for $100 less, you can get a different next-gen alternative along with a game and a poster, 3 Skylanders figures, 2 Swap Force character figures, trading cards, sticker sheets, and the Portal of Power required to play the game with your figures. Even more interesting is that it's also going to come with a Nintendo Land gamelet disc.
Oh, that's good.
So for $300, that's actually a tremendous value. You know what kind of, to me, is an even better value for $300?
What's that?
The new Wii U Deluxe bundle that includes new Mario Brothers U and the new Luigi U download content.
Now, this one, interestingly, does not come with Nintendo Land, but you can still get it on the eShop.
Indeed, you know, and I think the reason for that, and I sort of glossed over this prior, but the Skylanders set is a white basic unit, so it only has, you know, the 8 gigs of memory on board. This set, the Mario and Luigi set, comes with the...
With the two games?
Yeah, it's the deluxe set configuration, so a black 32-gig unit. So that's, you know, that's very interesting. Yeah, that Skylanders set also has 2 games, but, you know, Skylanders itself and Nintendo Land. But
right.
I certainly, if I were shopping for myself out there and I didn't have a Wii U, I would absolutely jump on this new Super Mario Brothers U set.
The other piece of information that is interesting, well, I mean, not interesting, but I mean important, is that the eShop Nintendo Land download will be $29.99, so definitely worth it. We've talked about how much we love Nintendo Land many times. And I think that both of these are great moves for the holiday season to try and be like, oh, let's go buy a Wii U for our children for Christmas. But I think particularly the Mario bundle, because, like, you know, moms might be at Walmart or Target or whatever being like, oh, look, there's 2 Super Mario games, and then there's the Mario game. Mario is a cat. I for some reason get a kick out of when people say Super Mario.
Super Mario.
Anyway, I think you want to talk about these, don't you? Because you were like,
Well, I do. You know, Nintendo has announced that they are going to be releasing in Japan 2 new strictly limited edition 3DS XL units. These are, of course, continuing the tradition of having two tones to the design. One is orange and one is turquoise, and they are, you know, like turquoise or orange tops against black bottoms. But even more interesting is that the buttons and D-pad and all of the volume switches and triggers are all also the same color as their respective clamshell.
Did you say stylus as well?
I didn't say it, but that is the case. These are going to be retailing in Japan for the U.S. equivalent of $205 on sale November 28th. We don't yet have any indication that these are coming out to North America, but I'm still holding out hope, crossing my fingers that we'll see them exclusive for Black Friday.
Is this what would get you to upgrade to 3DS XL?
If I could find one of these, I would absolutely buy it. I'd probably buy that orange one and then put on like a vinyl decal that I would probably cut by hand myself to make it look like a Pokeball.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, because that orange color it has, I think in the right light would probably look kind of reddish.
Yeah, I thought you were going to put like some spoopy stuff on there, like bats.
Spooky scary.
That would be awesome, though. Like, this is my spooky spiderweb-covered 3DS XL.
Colors. Is it just me, or is the 3DS, I don't know, like, specifically the original or the XL, but between the two of them, I think they probably have more color variations than, like, any video game device ever.
You know, I don't know if we're at that point yet. I would probably put that on the original DS. That's something we should have looked into when we did our episode on console reconfiguration releases.
Maybe we could do a micro about all the different colors of Game Boys and stuff.
That would be cute. Yeah, do a little follow-up that way in the micro format. In somewhat related news, Club Nintendo here in the U.S. is going to be offering a set of color-themed 3DS XL charging cradles starting October 31st. If you don't do Club Nintendo, I would highly recommend you look into it. You register your games and your consoles and all your Nintendo products with Nintendo and basically get free stuff for it. Sometimes they're free games, sometimes there's physical items like this that you can get. If you're someone who is already doing this, and there actually seems to be a pretty good chance that you are, if you're listening to this show, you might want to know that there is a cost associated with this, of course, and it is 500 coins. Probably, if you're like me, you already have one. I should say you already have 500 coins.
Yeah, you can also buy a plain black charging cradle for $20 if you're not into Club Nintendo or just don't have the resources to have 500 coins. But these ones will be in blue, green, yellow, red, and white. So if you want a pretty color, then go for it.
Go for it, dude!
Okay, dude!
Next up, we have news that an Amazing Spider-Man 2 video game is going to be coming out in 2014. Apparently, it's going to be launching for the PS4, Xbox 360, PS3, Xbox One, Wii U, PC, and 3DS systems, alongside the film currently slated for a May 2014 release. Polygon apparently caught this report from a Marvel panel at New York Comic Con. Apparently, it's not going to be a straightforward adaptation of the Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie, but will include scenarios featuring other Spider-Man villains from the Marvel Comics canon.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited for this. You know, I liked the Amazing Spider-Man movie a lot, and I know this isn't Spider-Man movie, so I won't stick on the topic for too long, but for such an interesting lore as Spider-Man has, and I've been reading a lot of Spider-Man comics recently, so this is sort of near and dear to my heart at the moment, but it really is a shame that for these movie games, you end up only with, like, one villain, and you end up playing this, like, 12 to 20-hour adventure in this movie game, just chasing, like, the lizard or something. And it's like, dude, are you serious? Spider-Man has a great rogues gallery. Like, why am I not fighting Green Goblin right now? I don't care if he wasn't in this movie.
Comics buoy.
Right.
So this one is very appropriate for today, but also, in a way, is a follow-up to our Shit Games episode. Because Deadly Premonition is getting a 352-page companion app for the iPad. It's going to be Deadly Premonition, the Director's Cut, the official visual companion, available for $9.99.
Okay, now that price is crappy. That should be known. I'm saying crappy, not crappy, although also that.
So yeah, if you're really into Deadly Premonition and you want an interactive ebook, then go for it.
It's worth mentioning that Deadly Premonition, the Director's Cut, will be launching on Steam on Halloween. So please look forward to that. In related news on Steam PC releases, Ikaruga has been greenlit for a PC release.
Ooh, that's one of your faves.
It absolutely is. Treasure has said that they have a few more tweaks to make to the game before it releases, but that things are already much further along than we would expect, so please look forward to it shortly. Now here is some news that has a very interesting little sidebar. And that is that the creators of Boogerman have launched a Kickstarter for Boogerman's 20th anniversary to make a quote-unquote new pick-and-flick adventure. Of course, you can find a link to this Kickstarter on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And, it basically does what it says on the tin. It's a HD 2D platformer revival of the Boogerman games. Of course, somewhat interestingly, recently, just in the last week, they announced that there will be a two-player co-op mode where the second player will play as Earthworm Jim.
I'm kind of here for that.
Yeah, I'm kind of super here for that. And the sidebar that I was talking about is that we recorded, in some amount of bad taste, a GameBuoy micro about games in which sort of dirty mechanics, like farting as a mechanic or as a storytelling device, games in which this was featured. We're going to upload that as a companion to this episode, but please be warned, it's awful, no pun intended, it's quite shitty. Please don't judge us on the merits of this GameBuoy micro that you see pop up alongside this episode. That having been said, we needed a break from our massive Castlevania marathon, and a great way to do it was talking about people pooping in games.
Yep.
So, please look forward to that, don't judge us too harshly, and obviously this episode that we're doing here is a little more, representative of the kinds of discussions that we try to have here on the show. Slackkick, can you please take this next news story?
I gladly will. So you might have been hearing about Rocksmith 2014. I've actually heard really, really great things about it. And of course, this is available now, but we have an article over at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org?
From Joystick, which has the complete track list if you are interested. And some really stand out to me. Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger.
Paranoid Android by Radiohead.
Radiohead, REM, Losing My Religion, although that's more of a mandolin Smith than Rocksmith.
Effing Knights of Sidonia by Muse.
Yes, yes.
Heart-Shaped Box by Nirvana.
Mm-hmm. Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones. Say It Ain't So by Weezer. If you're into hair metal, there's Round and Round by Rat.
Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Machine Head by Bush. And there's like Arctic Monkeys and Pantera and Paramore and Rise Against. And some Japanese stuff like Bees.
Bees!
I was not expecting you to do that. And the version of Knockin' on Heaven's Door is the Bob Dylan one, sorry. I know you're a Dylan fan, but I prefer the Guns N' Roses.
I actually feel the exact same way.
Controversial opinion, Bowie, today.
I am a huge Bob Dylan fan, but I'm sorry, Guns N' Roses.
So some of these...
Oh my gosh, also The Who, My Generation.
Oh yeah, yeah. So, some of these you can play in Rock Band or Guitar Hero games, but this one actually uses a real guitar.
You know,
do in Rock Band 3, but...
I have to say, actually, just the other day, priced the bundle of Rocksmith 2014 that comes with a guitar, because I'd kind of like to learn to play the guitar to impress somebody, and also make music.
That sounds like a great idea, then. I already play the guitar, but I really, especially with the positive reception this is beginning, I plan on picking this up.
Well, you better watch out. If I learn to play guitar, then we could put out a record where we both play guitars, and it could be science fiction-y and awesome.
Ooh.
How do you feel about a concept album?
Let's talk about Roundabout.
Cruel.
So this is in some ways a follow-up, but we haven't talked about them in a long time. You might remember that Dan Teasdale, I think he's kind of cute, right? He was kind of a hottie.
I think he was kind of all right.
Founded the indie studio called No Goblin, and you might remember that they're like, oh, they don't want to release games in like the genres that are like prevalent in gaming, like fantasy and stuff. They have announced a game called Roundabout. It is a limo driving game set in 1977. So you are going to have to do things like delivering kittens to orphans. So, kind of sounds crazy taxi-ish, but quirky and awesome. And you can green light it right now if you want. And I think you should, because, you know...
Dan Teasdale's Twitter name is Delicious Bees.
I already like him.
I can't find any pictures of him, though.
Keep looking.
Okay, you keep going on news, then.
Well, this is one that you would like, because it is a limited edition Monster Hunter 4 3DS that is coming to Japan. That will be on November 7th, and it's really pretty. You can see a link over at GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
And, you know, it's a pretty simple design, but it's got, like, a... I don't know what all the monsters are, but it's got, like, a monster on the front, like, in a white silhouette, kind of, in a pattern. Just go look at it at GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
Because it's pretty nice. I mean, I wouldn't get it. I'm not that big of a Monster Hunter fan, but if you are all
are
about
Monster
Hunter...
Are you even a little bit of a Monster Hunter fan?
I'm a little bit of a Monster Hunter fan. I had fun with 3.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to call you out like that. I am impressed and corrected.
In other news, Sega is 30 this year.
Oh, yeah, I do Dan Teasdale. Like, he's not a total hottie.
He's nerdy cute. So, anyways, it's Sega's 30th anniversary, and they've been commemorating that milestone, and... Yusuke Okunari, who is their CS research and development. What does CS mean? Am I just
customer service?
Oh, okay, research and development producer. And he was saying that.
Oh, maybe not then. IDK. Keep going.
Anyway, that future remakes and releases will depend on what fans want. Space Channel 5.
Space Channel 5.
And so it's a pretty interesting read. They kind of just, you know, sum up this Famitsu article, but he talks about Dragon Force and then kind of moving on to, you know.
Yeah, and you know, the cool thing about that, about the Sega Ages series in Japan, of course, is that these compilations, they'd be like basically single game compilations that would include like debug versions of games, early beta release, like unreleased beta versions of games, for games that were released in multiple regions. It would include like the US version and the European version and the Japanese version, so that you could really compare, like really have a proper archival experience for each game in these Sega Ages packs. It was really, really stupendous. And this guy is the one who really, you know, brought that to be the case. So he's a part of that anyway. So it's really encouraging to hear him saying, you know, that they're going to continue doing these releases and that they want fan input on what we want.
So, I don't remember if we talked about this, but 3D Sonic the Hedgehog for 3DS has Spin Dash. Did we talk about that?
Yeah, for the 3DS... 3D remakes of all the Genesis games. They made gameplay tweaks to all of them, and I think we talked about how the Genesis version, they had added Spin Dash in as an option that you could toggle on or off in a menu, not like before you even started the game.
I don't remember talking about that, and I'm like, wow, I kind of want to play that just for the experience.
Yeah, well, you know, like you would have to do to properly implement 3D, they rebuilt the game from the ground up. So supposedly it's an extremely accurate representation of the game, but with widescreen support, obviously, and it's supposed to be really quite good looking as well. So I'm really, they've given us some indication that this will be coming to the US. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope it comes soon.
Definitely. Hyperdimension Neptunia PPI will be coming to the West in 2014 for PlayStation Vita. Kind of.
I'll probably buy that. Like, I
kind of explains itself.
It.
I have yet to play any of the Hyperdimension Neptunia games, but the,
we can change that after this episode.
The,
if you like.
I didn't realize that the world is called Game Industry. Like, literally, Game Industry ends with an I. And Hyperdimension Neptunia, of course, is the series where you are basically be playing as characters that represent game consoles. So it's very meta.
It's a meta game game?
Meta game game. Meta game.
Meta game game.
Didn't Metapod talk like Metapod?
Metapod. I don't think Metapod said anything. Metapod ain't got a mouth, does he?
It was like... Do you want to talk about the PS4 day one patch? Because you're probably going to be the only one of the two of us who will have a PS4 on day one.
Basically, there's going to be a 300 meg patch on PlayStation 4's launch day that will enable online multiplayer, remote play, sharing, the video broadcasting. It'll also be what activates the Blu-ray and DVD playback on the unit. It is going to allow, you know, for other users to log into your system. So basically, you're downloading the operating system that they've been selling you on for the last 6 months. This obviously would indicate that the operating system isn't finished or complete yet. But in this day and age, I'm actually not that worried about it.
I feel like at least it's not a one gigabyte patch like our beloved Wii U.
Yeah, 1.5 gigabyte patch.
Oh, was it 1.5?
Yeah. So, and I didn't even think that was a problem. You know, I discussed it back then. It upset me that it was misrepresented as 5 gigabytes. Like, that was not true. But even still, you know, sometimes these things just come together later than you plan, and you already have your pipelines set. You have your units shipping out to stores. People are demanding a product on a specific day. And you just have to, you know, push back your schedule on your software and patch it in after. So I'm not that concerned of this. I've seen a lot of people on the internet, a lot of pundits, gaming pundits, can you believe? That's the state of the world now. Talking about how this is a bad sign and people should jump ship. I have seen a lot of people jump ship on the PS4 lately, many of them going for the Wii U, but those are for reasons we'll get to a little later. As far as this day one patch, I don't think it's a cause for concern. I'm very excited for the PS4. I have doubled down. I'm definitely getting a PS4 on launch day, and I couldn't possibly be more excited about it at this point. So, please look forward to it.
Great. This next one's a little fun tidbit coming up to us from Silicon Era. Apparently, the beta version of the unreleased Toe Jam and Earl 3 for Dreamcast, which is not to be confused with Toe Jam and Earl 3 Mission to Earth for the Xbox, has been found. And so some footage is available over at Silicon Era, which you can find the link to, of course, on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And the person who owns the disc is planning on holding a fundraiser in order to release the code online. So that's kind of neat. Do you have anything to say about that, Captain Spike?
I hope that this happens. I'd like to play this.
Yeah. So, Sonic and All-Star Racing is going to be coming to smartphones, along with Rhythm Thief. Rhythm Thief.
I am the Rhythm Thief.
This is actually going to be a new Rhythm Thief game that I understand.
Say goodbye to the beat.
Called Rhythm Thief and the Paris Captor. The 3DS title was called Rhythm Thief and the Emperor's Treasure. This will be available
exciting.
In 2014. We don't have any strange shots that I have seen yet of the mobile version of All-Stars Transformed, but it's going to have local and online multiplayer for up to 4 players and some sort of social element.
And did you... I didn't hear you say this. If you did, I apologize. I had a text I had to send, but... Hell rude, sorry. But they're also going to be releasing a remastered version of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for iOS and Android, running on the quote-unquote Taxman engine that they used for that remake of Sega CD. Taxman!
Woo-woo!
Fighter of the Income Man!
How dare you not take it to the obvious Beatles place like I just did?
Because this isn't music snob, Booey Fool.
All right, here's another Monster Hunter news. Would you like to take it?
You know, it's even better because this is not just Monster Hunter news. It's also Geist Crusher news. You know, we've been talking here a lot about Geist Crusher, a game that is often described as Capcom's attempt at marketing the Monster Hunter playstyle of games to kids, effectively, using, you know, a Shonen Sentai type setup. And now we have confirmation of the first crossover from Monster Hunter into Geist Crusher. There is going to be a boss that is Rothalos from Monster Hunter.
Cool.
No news yet on if you'll get his Geist Stone or whatever to turn into him, as we've discussed on previous episodes, but I'm sure there'll be some kind of cool trick that you get for beating him, so please look forward to it.
So this is a little interesting tidbit. Square Enix has formed the Final Fantasy Committee to ensure the quality of future Final Fantasy games. It's not confirmed that, you know, 14's original release was responsible for this, but, you know, I think it's good to see that the folks over at Square Enix are committed to making sure that games that are part of the Final Fantasy franchise will, you know, have a higher degree of quality control.
You know, to me, the most interesting part of this, and I sort of had to read over it, but, you know, I see Yoshida-san here, I see Tabata-san here, I see Toriyama-san here, I see Kitase-san here. Do you know who I do not see listed here?
Nomura-san. Well, because he's busy with a bunch of other stuff, so.
Including Final Fantasy XV, which he's directing, so. Yep. His absence on the Final Fantasy Committee is strange and interesting to me. Noteworthy, yes.
Well, I mean, let's be real. Pretty much everything that Nomura-san has touched in the past decade has been pretty much a gem.
You know, it's funny to hear you say that. I certainly agree with it. I think that a lot of Square Enix's biggest hits of the last decade, I'd even say the last two decades at this point, because we're looking, you know, Final Fantasy VII as well. I would say, yeah, that Nomura-san has had his hands, you know, pretty deep in the pie. I don't even know if that's a real idiom, but I just made it up. He's had his hands
he's
in
like,
the pie.
He's like, I'm eating this pie.
Whatever.
Like making the pie or eating the pie?
Hopefully eating. Just, like, by the handful, just like, om nom nom nom.
I'm not really sure I followed the metaphor anymore, but keep going.
So, he's had a finger in the pie. Is that a real idiom?
I don't know. Let's just move on. Let's just
anyway,
move on.
Nomura-san has had a hand in each of the more successful Square Enix products of the last, like, 20 years, I would say. So it's strange to see that he's not involved in this Final Fantasy committee. But perhaps it's simply because their current big Final Fantasy project is already being headed up by Nomura, so it'd be redundant to have him on the committee, maybe. Hi, DK.
Yeah.
Moving on, I know that you like Assassin's Creed a lot. Why don't you talk about this?
Yeah, this is kind of neat news. Assassin's Creed Liberation is getting an HD remaster.
We had talked once about a rumor as such. It's good to see it, you know, confirmed and discussed.
Yeah, it's going to be available on January 14th. I'm hoping that it is... I mean, you know, I guess I'd never really pay too much attention to whether they fixed a lot of the bugs that were in...
My understanding is that they have done a couple patches and that the game is a lot more stable now on Vita.
Because when I was trying to play Liberation on my Vita, like, it had a lot of great ideas, but it was just such a mess the way that it was executed. So I'll be excited to see if Liberation HD is more successful at, you know, being a game that works. I also thought that Assassin's Creed 3 was a total mess in terms of, you know, just being glitchy and broken. I wasn't a fan.
Yeah. I liked some of the game concepts in 3 a lot. I'm interested in seeing them expanded in 4. But it definitely had a lot of system error issues.
I did not like the way that ship battles worked in 3.
Stability issues is the word I was looking for.
So I'm hoping that 4's ship battles are a lot better control-wise.
I liked the ship battles, but I am more interested in how they're going to be done in 4. It looks like they're going to have a lot more diversity, a lot more options, and just a lot more content and a lot more to do in 4. So I'm looking forward to that. And I wanted to point out that Assassin's Creed Liberation HD will be launching January 14th on PlayStation 3. The PC and 360 releases are yet to be scheduled.
Yeah, and in a similar note with Ubisoft content being exclusive for Sony consoles, the exclusive PS3, PS4 content for Assassin's Creed 4 and Watch Dogs will be PS3, PS4 exclusive for 6 months.
Interesting. I mean,
which is good news for me because I'm pretty much on the Sony bandwagon these days. Someone was just talking, was it Wicked, who was saying that, oh, yeah, it's like I hate Sony. I'm like, actually, no, that's I buried that hatchet like almost a year ago. So, yeah, so that's good news. You know, unfortunately, like I said a couple months ago, I'm going to have to hold off on PS4, but, you know, I'll be picking these games up on PS3, so.
Yeah, yeah, and you know.
And I'll get timed exclusive content.
And these are games that, you know, and maybe you'll have your PS4 by the time Watch Dogs comes out, which, ooh, spoiler alert, that's a news story we're going to be talking about in a minute.
Yeah.
But certainly for Assassin's Creed, you might be able to do the $10 upgrade thing and then just get your upgraded $10 copy for PS4 once you have a PS4.
Well, it depends on how long that deal lasts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's something that you sign up for on PSN, so you could probably buy it even if you don't have the PS4 yet, and it would be presumably on your account. I don't know.
Oh, I
see. For $10 to me, like, why not?
I see what you mean. Like, upgrade your license, basically.
Yeah.
But then does that mean that you can't use the
PS4? The game disc? If it's a download, I think you can't use it anymore, but if you have the retail disc copy, then yeah, you can still use that.
Interesting.
So... yeah,
we'll have to investigate.
It was just a thought. I don't even know if it would work out, but it's something you should look into. I'm really excited. In any event, you know, we know that the Assassin's Creed 4 exclusive content ties into the story of Liberation, and the main character from Liberation, I guess, has several playable missions that continue her story.
Oh, very cool.
And I thought that was the most incredible part of Liberation. Was seeing that character's story progress, and I actually thought it was really quite an incredible game from that perspective. So I'm very excited. This, for me, sort of sealed the deal. I was going to get Assassin's Creed 4 on Wii U, but now I'm definitely just going to go PS4. So
yeah, well, anything on Wii U third-party these days is kind of meh.
Well, and you know, we didn't talk about it here as a full talking point, but there was some tweets and some online information indicating that the Wii U version of Assassin's Creed 4 was not going to get any DLC support down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So that's shady and awful and super gross. And hey, speaking of Ubisoft shitting on Wii U owners, Rayman Legends and Splinter Cell Blacklist both missed their sale targets.
Oh, maybe it's because you took a game that was supposed to be Wii U exclusive, cut a bunch of content, and then delayed it so that you could put it out on PS360.
Well, to be fair, they didn't cut content per se, so much as they created new methods of exploring that content for people that weren't using the Wii U gamepad. And it's worth noting, you know, we're obviously talking and complaining about Rayman Legends, which was supposed to release back in February, and ultimately released in August as a multi-platform title, the Wii U version still sold the best.
Interesting.
So what this tells me most importantly, like I personally really strongly feel that if this game had launched in February, when, as sales numbers monthly indicate for the Wii U, you know, there actually was not that many fewer Wii U owners. Like, the Wii U did not gain a lot of owners in that six-month period, but the people who did own Wii U's, and there were millions of them already at that point, were starved for content. What it means to me, that this correlation of data that I'm making here, is that if Ubisoft had released earlier, they probably could have cashed in on way more purchases than coming in the last week of August in the UK and the first week of September here in the US, And I think they really could have gotten a lot more sales rather than, you know, coming up right before Grand Theft Auto 5 and all kinds of other super high-profile releases. No, you release in February, I think you probably would have sold a lot more units of this game. And you wouldn't have incurred the cost of porting it to other consoles. And if you really had to do the other console release, do them as Game of the Year editions with new content 6 months later. There's precedent for it. I feel like they made the absolute worst choice, and I don't want to say that I'm pleased to see this blow up in their faces, because I'm not. Anytime a game performs poorly, there's a huge risk in seeing more content like that created. There's obviously a huge risk that people could lose their jobs. And I certainly don't want either of these things to happen. That would be the worst. But it is somewhat gratifying that all of us Wii U owners were basically saying, give us this content right now, we want it. When the game did release, the Wii U owners, us, were like, yes, this is awesome, hooray! And everyone else was like, huh? What? Like, I'm not here for this. So basically, it totally, to me, justified and validated the months and months and months of QQ that we all had about this game.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
Moving on to our last bit of news for the day, we have confirmation from Ubisoft that their PlayStation 4 launch titles are not going to be launch titles.
Oops.
Watch Dogs and The Crew have both been delayed deep into 2014, with quarter 2 being the earliest we will see either. In particular, we're expecting Watch Dogs to hit in the first quarter of Ubi's fiscal year, so between April and June, and The Crew to launch in their second fiscal quarter, so between July and September. This is obviously, as you can tell, you know, pretty big delays for both of these games. We're looking potentially at, you know, 6 to 9 months longer for these games than we were expecting.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, especially since I'm sure that, you know, Watch Dogs was probably something that, you know, most people wanted to pick up for their next-gen consoles and might swing them the other way to, you know, wait, which that would suck that it would have hardware implications, because, you know, it was a big, big buzz title.
Well, you know, I know a lot of people out there on the internet and certainly some IRL friends who were already had done pre-sales for the Watch Dogs PS4 bundle that Sony was doing. My understanding is that this news of this delay came up so late that Sony had already printed the cardboard boxes for the bundles to come in with Watch Dogs.
Oh.
Like, this came in real last minute, you know, just 2.5-3 weeks before the damn thing comes out. That is abnormal, crazy, and strange.
Yeah.
So, just really just baffles the mind. It's very crazy. And, you know, there is a corresponding flip side to this point. However, and apparently we here at GameBuoy.org are not the only ones who think that Ubisoft's delays of these titles, was a bad idea for the company. The day after the announcement of these delays happened, Ubisoft's stock shares fell 26%.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a pretty big dip for your stocks to go. And, you know, I'm seeing people everywhere talking about how, you know, they were going to go PS3 this November and December, you know, this holiday season. PS3, PS4. But a lot of these people are now saying that they're going to go in the direction of the Wii U.
Thought you were going to say Xbox One, and I was like, no!
Well, no, because Xbox One is also not getting Watch Dogs now.
Right, right.
In this time period. No one is anywhere. So now you have to drop down to, like, the next tier of, like, well, what other games are coming out this year that I want to play? And for a surprising amount of people, including Eurogamer Magazine did an article on this very fact today. I say magazine, but I mean their website. As did Edge, you know, both saying that, especially with Watch Dogs out of the picture, the only real worthwhile console purchase this year now is the Wii U. We have Mario 3D World on the horizon. We have, you know,
Wind Waker HD.
Wind Waker HD, yes. Pikmin 3 is already on store shelves. Wonderful 101. We have, obviously, We Fit You coming. A lot of people are probably interested in that. We have Wii Party U is out now already.
How come you don't have that? We could have had a Wii Party tonight.
We should probably have bought that today. Yeah, we should be doing that. Gosh darn it.
There's always next time.
So, now, you know, it's funny because Wii U has this stigma of having no titles on shelves, no compelling game content. But now at this point, you know, come hell or high water this holiday season, there is now one game console that has games on it that people want to play in terms of next gen consoles, and it is not the Xbox One or the PlayStation 4. So this is, you know, it's a very interesting turning of tables. Obviously, who knows if the Wii U can overcome the stigma that it already has levied against it. You know, we didn't talk about this specifically because it's not a Game Buoy title. But the PlayStation 4 launch title that was supposed to be the PlayStation Plus PS4 launch game that people would get free and what have you, that has also been delayed into 2014. So really, for a lot of people now, like for me now, my launch day PS4 game is going to be Lego Marvel Heroes.
Ooh.
And I mean, that's fine. I'm looking forward to the game, and you know, I'll pick up Assassin's Creed, but at this point, a big part of why I'm buying that thing is to talk about it here on the show. Before, I was buying it because I was very, very excited to play Watch Dogs on that console.
Wasn't that game Knack also coming out on launch
day? It is. I have zero interest in Knack. I don't know why. For whatever reason, like, I try to get interested, and I'm not at all.
It's the Little Big Planet of this this generation.
I think that's how I'm interpreting it, because I have the same problems with Knack that I have with Little Big Planet. It looks like the kind of game that I would like to play, except with a super casual, non-gameplay focused focus, that for me is just, I can't deal with. Like, Little Big Planet, I love 2D platformers, but man, you give me floaty physics and loose, unreliable controls, and really poorly communicated depth of field platforming. That's a problem.
I remember when, just as a side note, I remember when you were saying this in front of Seawolf Jason, and he looked like you had, like, wounded him. Seawolf Jason loves Little Big Planet.
Well, he loves the game, and that's cool. I know a lot of people who do, but I'm sorry. To me, the integrity of control in a platform game must come before all other things. And in that game, the focus is building worlds and communicating and party time, blah, blah, blah. And that's cool. It's just not for me. That is not what I'm looking for in that game experience. That's how I feel about Knack. It looks cool, similar, like creation, customize, communicate, focus, and that's cool. But what I want in a 3D platformer is like crazy huge set pieces with fun, like almost puzzle mechanics and fights and intensive combat and strategic, like dodging and reflex based controls. And I'm not looking for fun time with my kids that don't exist.
Well, maybe someday.
Yeah, probably not. So,
King Dewey Jr. If we ever adopt children, we'll make them record a podcast.
Right, and that'll be our spinoff branch. We're going to do something we don't normally do. We're going to take a very brief intermission. For us, it'll probably be a couple of minutes. For all of you out there in Internet Radio Land, it's probably going to be another 5 seconds while we have a little jingle or something. Please look forward to it, and thank you kindly. And welcome back, boys and ghouls.
Ooh.
I hope you enjoyed that little break as much as I did. So with that, it's time to get into this discussion. And, you know, we're going to talk about horror games here. You know, and I want to sort of take a moment here and explain. We're going to do things a little differently than we have in the past done with some of these discussions. We're going to talk about just like maybe like 5 games here. And we're going to talk about them hopefully a little more in depth than usual. You know, a lot of times we end up just talking about the game, its release details. We talk just a little bit about our personal experiences, and then we move on. And we end up only devoting to each game a minute or two, if that. And I want to dig a little deeper. I want to go into a little bit more of our personal experiences and a little bit more of the impact each of these five games had on the market for horror games. And, you know, maybe do a more exhaustive sort of the history of horror games at a later date. Part of the hope here also is that, you know, doing things this way does open up the door to also doing similar looks at things like Slag Kick's much-desired puzzle games episode. So,
I love puzzle games.
I know you do, and I think it would be great to talk about them. I have come around. I am pro-puzzle games buoy, and I expect that we'll probably do something like that in the next few months.
All right, well, let's talk about
your Tetris musical ready.
Well, let's talk about some spoopy and crappy things.
Well, I think the spoopiest, and the one that I would most like to start with, is probably going to be... is going to be 2010's Alan Wake.
Oh, yeah.
This was developed by Remedy Entertainment and published by Microsoft Game Studios. It was originally just an Xbox 360 game, but after years of fan demand, it finally, just last year, got a Windows port. I think we talked about that here on the show. This is the kind of thing we talked about.
It's a Steam release, right? Because I'm pretty sure I own them both on Steam.
Yeah, that is correct. And, you know, Remedy Studios, of course, is probably most notable for the Max Payne series.
Right.
But only one and two. They did not do Max Payne 3, which, Rockstar did last year. But, anyway, Alan Wake, really incredible game in my opinion. It is a horror game in sort of the more mystery sense. But I really wanted to talk about it most specifically after we got a tweet, possibly a Facebook message somewhere. I don't know, one of our social media feeds.
By MailBuoy.
Or MailBuoy. I don't think it was MailBuoy. No one really uses MailBuoy. It makes me and MailBuoy very sad. He even talks to me, he's like, hey guys, it really makes me sad that you guys don't mail me. So, like, I don't know. It wasn't that funny. You can stop laughing, dude. You okay. Love when I do that voice. I don't know why.
MailBuoy's so cute.
But as I was saying, we got a message from one of our listeners in regard to our question of the week. And one of our listeners wanted to see the return of psychological horror.
Hey, you're encroaching on my segment.
I didn't say who sent it. I'm letting you do that.
Hey, fine. Keep going.
But to me, that's why Alan Wake is so well-loved. It's a psychological thriller. It has some action elements, but not very much. We're going to talk about another psychological thriller and one of my very personal favorite horror games of all time, in just a few minutes. But I first wanted to talk about Alan Wake. You know, it's about a writer. He writes horror novels. He's very sort of, almost like a stand-in for like a Stephen King character. And, you know, King is referenced in the game several times. In fact, he was very
specific. That's right up your alley.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of Stephen King. He's referenced in the game. He was, you know, discussed as sort of the inspiration for the character, and he was lightly involved in the game.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Very lightly, less of, like, using him for, like, he didn't write anything for them, but they consulted with him in some very, very superficial ways about life as a horror writer or what have you. And, you know, basically this character, I don't want to give away the plot, but some spooky things start happening to him while he's in a cabin in the woods. No relation to the game Cabin in the Woods. Or game, movie Cabin in the Woods. Sorry, I'm a little sloppy. What basically plays out is like a combination of an episode of The Twilight Zone and a Stephen King novel.
That sounds pretty great.
It's super good. There's a very, very light combat focus. Like, there is combat in the game, but the real focus is like this light and dark mechanic and just this creepy mystery happening around you as you're trying to survive without it being a survival horror game, which we're not exactly talking about here, but we will talk about a game that's codified as survival horror. But it's just, to me, it's a real great game. It's kind of unlike most other horror games, in that I felt like the story is actually a really great, really gripping, thrilling tale that maintains narrative cohesiveness. Like, it's not the Resident Evil storyline where they just throw some bat shit at you constantly about, oh, it's the T-Virus! Oh, pork chop sandwiches!
Wait, that's really the plot of one of the Resident Evil games?
No, there are not pork chop sandwiches in a Resident Evil game, but there are, like, some mystery viruses and some superhuman paramilitary commander and people harvesting zombie DNA for superpowers and some twins that were born psychic and can have telekinetic powers or something. And I don't know. The whole thing is just a complete mess to me. And so I was really taken by this sort of more, and, you know, maybe that's a difference between Eastern and Western storytelling philosophy and sensibility, because this is more of what you would see, again, like in a Twin Peaks or Twilight Zone or a Stephen King novel of an ordinary person being flung into this extraordinarily terrifying situation. And it plays out more like an interactive horror movie with a solid little like combat-y game engine on top of it. So I'm really into it. If you like strong narratives and you're interested in that kind of horror, I highly, 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 highly recommend you look into Alan Wake. This, to me, is one of the recent greats of the horror genre. Or, you know, I would almost say, and I'd be interested, Slykick, in hearing what you have to say, I would almost not describe horror as a genre, but more of almost like a motif of games.
Yeah, I can see that, particularly with some of the ones we'll be discussing at the end of our discussion topic.
Excellent, excellent.
And now, right. Alan Wake had a sequel, or was it a sequel or just like a extra chapter, American Nightmare?
American Nightmare is a sequel, but it's not... See, this is strange, because it's a sequel in that it's standalone. It's not DLC. And Alan Wake does have two DLC chapters, both of which are good. The game is structured in, like, episodic chapters, although it did not release episodically. It's just a really interesting way. Something else that's really cool about Alan Wake, man, the more I think about it, the more I just want to talk about this game for this whole episode, basically. Alan Wake Buoy. They did, like, a TV series, like a Twin Peaks-style TV series within the game world that you can watch on the TV in the game world. And it's just, it's so cool. Anyway, American Nightmare is more of an in-universe spin-off than a sequel. The game, you know, it is more of like a combat-based game, but it still utilizes like a lot of psychological horror tropes, except it takes it to almost more of like a Quentin Tarantino-style outlook. So you have a lot of trope inversion. In fact, it plays out as if you're in an episode of this spooky anthology series that I was talking about within the in-universe, Night Springs. And the game sort of plays out as if you're in an episode of Night Springs.
So it's not really, like, canon?
So no, that's why I was trying to frame sort of how it's not really a sequel per se.
So it's Dead Rising 2 off the record.
Sort of, yeah. And they have discussed, they know that there's interest in a sequel, and there is more story to be told. So, to me, that's really exciting. And especially, you know, with the DLC man, those DLC chapters were super good. Like, that was almost Astra's Wrath tier in terms of quality of DLC.
Great.
So, that's about all I have to say about Alan Wake. Do you have anything, Slagkick, that you would like to say about the games Uninvited and or Shadowgate?
Do you want to just get the basics out of the way first? Or do you want my opinions about them right away?
Why don't you give me your opinions? Because I feel like that'll make for better radio, and then we'll flop back and do sort of the maintenance work, so to speak.
Okay, so I like Uninvited better than Shadowgate.
Excellent.
Because in Shadowgate, I couldn't figure out how to get past the first room.
Oh, man, you open Skull, yeah?
Yeah, because that makes sense. But, I mean, the thing is that interesting to me is that, you know, these games predate pretty much... Actually, they predate everything else that we're talking about today, so...
Well, Uninvited, just to put perspective here, you're right. It would have been better to do it this way. Uninvited was originally a Mac game.
A Mac Venture game.
A Mac Venture game, indeed, that came out in 1986. The NES port, which is what we played in preparation for this episode, and I had played as a kid, released in 1991. For Shadowgate, this was also a Mac Venture game, and I would say the most popular of the Mac Venture games. It released for the Macintosh in 1987, but in a flip, the NES version of this came out before the NES version of Uninvited. The NES version of Shadowgate
every
hit
time
1989.
You say Uninvited, I'm like, you're uninvited. And I hear like the little piano rip. Whoa. Wow. You went for it.
Sorry. I am so sorry that just happened.
Because I had not been exposed to these as a child. So, I think the thing that is interesting to me in the context of what we're discussing today is that a lot of the elements that we come to think of in horror games, or, survival horror, we'll get into that. But, having to look around at things around you, kind of not having the game hold your hand and tell you where to go, kind of leaving it up to you to, determine where you need to go and what to do. And, I mean, even to the degree of having not unlimited resources, having limited resources, if you're...
Shadowgate and its infamous torches.
Yeah, you cannot just stand around and, take your time or else death is going to come and get you, literally. I was playing Uninvited and I was like, okay, I'm doing better at this. I'm going through, exploring the house, and then I found some lady who was like, oh, she looks like Scarlett O'Hara. But then I was like, okay, where should I go next? And then it's like, she turned into like a demon and it's like, you're dead.
Yeah, oh man, I watched
cackling. These are not very forgiving games, and I mean, even though, it's, when you say horror game, you might not think of these. I mean, there's definitely those elements, and, that I think were very influential when it came around to, these survival horror. Well,
you talk about how unforgiving these games are. And I want to say, from a game design perspective, to me, one of the most important things you can have in a game, regardless of genre, is some amount of tension. When you look at a game like, let's say, Kirby's Epic Yarn, there was zero tension to the gameplay
effect. Well, yeah, it's meant to be inoffensive and friendly for children.
But you look at people, even you, for example, had a hard time with that game's lack of tension. I seem to recall you saying that it felt like since you couldn't do anything to fail, it was less interesting and less engaging to you as a player. That was what I recall you saying. Am I misremembering? It could have been, admittedly, someone else who said these things.
As far as Epic Yarn, I think I just said that, it was, light and fluffy and, it made it like a stress-free experience. So I kind of think I approached it from that way. But
Okay, that's,
which, I mean,
that's
is
a
an
very
important
accurate
distinction
read.
Because
yeah, no,
playing
totally.
These games can be very stressful.
Well, and I was just going to say, to me, for something like Uninvited or Shadowgate...
Uninvited! Keep going.
Is that, for a horror game, you want a lot of tension. You want... this sense of dread, you want the atmosphere of fear. So, to me, it's very effective to use this, to create this tension in your game design by having every choice you make, even something as potentially inoffensive as simply moving forward, be like, oh, this could be my very last move in this game. I could be dying 5 seconds from now, through no real fault of my own, except not knowing that there was a hidden danger.
Choose your own adventure, as you said to me as we were playing.
Indeed. And I think that this works well for horror games. I think that you want, for horror, if you're really going for a horrific, scary, spoopy game, you really want to sort of approach it from the angle of a tense experience. And that, to me, is why you see in a lot of these horror games a lot of the old tropes that, technologically speaking, you could overcome now. Slow, cumbersome controls, so that you have to really stop and think about, like, my animation to pull out this knife in Resident Evil is going to take me, like, a second and a half. So now I'm in a real tense spot because I don't know if I want to fight or flight right now, because I have so much to lose. That creates a sense of tension and dread that I think elevates the horror aspect of the experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think just talking about horror as a genre in general, whether it's fiction, you know, I mean, like...
No, the tension is, very important. That's
suspense,
the key element.
I mean, in film, cinema, literature.
Oh, absolutely. I was simply talking about how that tension comes up in games.
Oh, yeah, I'm just saying that I think it's a crucial part of that.
And I think that these games, Uninvited and Shadowgate, really ratchet the tension up by, again, even even having a scenario, again, in the first room of Shadowgate where potentially you could you imagine buying this game in, what did we say, 87, 88 or whatever, and literally not being able to get past the first room?
I would have thrown such a fit.
And then if you did...
I almost did in Gameplay Studio.
And then if you did get through it, could you imagine how, like, oh man, I finally got through it, thank God, I don't want to die now. And then bam, you probably die coming up on someone who...
Because you took too long and your torches went out.
Like, that's tension. Like, man, it took me so long to get through there, now I have to rush. Oh, this is... I'm sweating, my heart is beating faster. I feel like these games are very great at evoking this sense of dread and tension.
I mean, I think that's just goes to show for games that early in the history of gaming, you know, to be so well designed in that way.
Oh, absolutely. You
I
know,
mean,
we...
not to say that a game like a Super Mario Brothers isn't well designed.
Oh, no, it's incredibly well designed, simply in a different way. Again, as horror goes, I look at these humble beginnings, and I couldn't say... categorically or with any amount of authority that these are the earliest horror games. But for me, it's a good stepping stone because right out the gate, you have these scary early horror games that, to me, are very effective at making me feel dread.
Yeah, it's not to the point where I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel like something's going to jump out and scare at me. But, you know, it definitely has that element of suspense. And I think, you know, playing it as an adult, I found it funny when, you know, like, oh, the Scarlet O'Hara lady is turning into a demon now. Is that the sound that she makes?
I am in my imagination. I don't know.
So, shall we move on?
Well, and just for completest's sake, I want to real quick just mention that there were two other MacVenture games. We're not discussing them here because they weren't horror games. But they were both film noir games and really excellent experiences.
That's right.
That is Deja Vu and Deja Vu 2, which, I mean, Deja Vu 2 is a little redundant, eh? But Deja Vu hit on the Mac in 85. The NES port was released in 1990 in the U.S. Deja Vu 2 was released on the Mac in 1988. And, you know, Wikipedia doesn't have release information for Deja Vu 2, but I feel quite certain that it came out on the NES. But I can't prove it, so maybe it didn't. But I think it did. It got a DOS port in any event in 1990. I'm sure that if you really wanted to play it, you could DOSBox it.
DOSBox. So I know, obviously, Shadowgate has lived on. Did Uninvited ever have any sequels or spiritual sequels?
You know, not that I'm aware of. Someone did mention to me a game called The Legacy, Realm of Terror. But I'm not really terribly sure how that fits into this big picture here.
Because Shadowgate had, I mean, it's Shadowgate 64, and then there was the one before that, right? Was it 3DO or something?
Yeah, there was even, I think it even had like a Game Boy port or something.
Game Boy.
And, you know, there was
Shadowgate Returns.
Yeah, there was that Kickstarter, I was just going to say. So, you know, that did make its funding level. It made its stretch goals. So I have to assume that we're going to see that come back someday. I'd have to assume. I mean, we're on track to see that return someday soon.
Maybe for next year's Halloween buoy.
Halloween buoy. Yeah, this spooky focus is going to be an annual thing, guys and girls. We love horror here in the Game Buoy Studios, and I know many of you out there do too, so please continue looking forward to scary episodes from us. Now, Slagkick, you and I need to hurry this up. So, let's talk about Resident Evil 4. Resident Evil 4, of course,
I thought we were talking about horror games.
Sick burn, bro. We're going to talk about that, and my use of the word bro in this context, referring to the fact that Resident Evil 4 was sort of the broification of the series, the beginnings of the broification. This was, of course, developed by Capcom's Production Studio 4. I bring this angle up, of course, because that's sort of a big deal in the context of, you know, this was Shinji Mikami's last real game with Capcom in a lot of ways, because of this game. Mikami-san very famously stated that Resident Evil 4 would never get ported to other platforms, and he swore to GameCube owners that he would cut off his own head before he let this happen, it getting ported. About a year after its release for the GameCube, it got a PlayStation 2 port, and Mikami-san left Capcom over it. This is generally considered the straw that broke the camel's back and, you know, led Mikami to leaving, going to Clover, ending up at Platinum, and then going on to, you know, do his own studio with The Evil Within, which hopefully we'll be talking about next year.
So this
is actually, like, it's a very important game in sort of the history of gaming from that perspective. At least as important as Goof Troop. Actual fact, look it up or listen to earlier episodes of Game Buoy here.
Game Buoy.
For the sake of sticking to just the facts, I want to point out that this released in 2005 on the GameCube, late 2005 for the PlayStation 2. The GameCube version launched in January, the PlayStation 2 version launched in November. It also had a Windows port in 2007, around the same time as which the well-known Wii edition was released.
Oh, yeah. That was very well-received.
It was very well-received. A lot of people feel like the Wii version is sort of the optimal, like,
the definitive.
Like definitive release because of the pointer controls. There was also an iPhone, mobile phone, and iPad version that came out between 2008 and 2010 in various iterations. And it also, just a couple of years ago, in 2011, toward the end of 2011, got ports to Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3.
Now, those were HD remasters, right?
They were HD remasters, but they've had very little done to them.
Yeah, the texture work really wasn't, enhanced much.
I played the PlayStation 3 version today, and I have to say, aside from the simple fact of running at a higher resolution. Other than that, I didn't see a single thing in it that wasn't present in the GameCube version.
And it doesn't look bad, by any means. It looked good on the GameCube.
I would actually say that a lot of effects from the GameCube version were toned down or not used. Like, I would actually say I felt that game looked better on GameCube than it did on PlayStation 3. Specifically some of the hair movement, it was like, wow, you know, the PlayStation 2 port of this, compared to the GameCube port, I'm going somewhere with this, just bear with me, was notable for being very toned down. A lot of the texture work was a little bit better, but the modeling was all noticeably worse, to the point where, like, characters who have bald spots on their head where their hair didn't,
I hope it wasn't Leon.
Where they had to remove, like, I don't know, polygons or something in such a way that their hair would clip through their head and they'd have bald spots. Some of the technical aspects I couldn't really say. A lot of, like, barrels and things were not rounded, so they were, like, boxy with just, like, round textures on them.
Ew.
Yeah, it was a real mess. And I felt like the PlayStation 3 HD remaster, while running at a higher resolution, I felt like it had some of those issues where, like, the GameCube version of this, like, those characters looked much better. What is going on here? So that's, I mean, that's just an interesting footnote. If you haven't played Resident Evil 4, I actually would recommend it. Resident Evil, to me, is notable because, and this is where we're finally getting to discussion of the game, sorry, is really notable to me because it's like they took all of the survival horror tropes that had been established in the survival horror games of sort of the late 90s, PlayStation 1, they all sort of took off at around the same time. You know, you had Clock Tower and Resident Evil and Silent Hill. And a lot of these tropes became real codified at that point, and you had to have these gameplay elements and what have you.
Like limited resources.
A lot of tension generated just from awkward, sluggish controls, things coming at you, you know, off screen or what have you. You know, guns, lots of guns.
Guns, lots of guns.
Man, I make the baddest bitches buy me guns.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah, when we're making Nicki Minaj references, you know we got to go. So, to me, the interesting thing about Resident Evil 4, from a game design perspective, is that I actually feel like it's the start of the game becoming not spooky. You know, earlier Resident Evils are very, even when they're silly and have their ridiculous stories and nonsensical voice acting and dialogue, still, they're trying to cultivate a certain atmosphere. With Resident Evil 4, I feel like that pretty much went all the way out the window, and it seems to me like sort of the solidification and presentation of just straight up, here's the gameplay that you love, here is the tension, here is the survival horror sort of, resource management, you are overcrowded with enemies, you have to figure out whether you're going to fight or flight right now, and this is all crammed into a game, and we're just going to forget all about atmosphere and plot, and we're just going to feel like it
did, like, mechanically, it's a good game, but it doesn't scare me.
Well, and I think that is true for a lot of people, actually. I have noticed, you know, a lot of people cite this game as their personal favorite game of all time. I've seen a lot of people talk about how they feel objectively that it's the best game of all time. And a lot of people. We probably have people listening to this. Well, maybe not this show, because our listeners are all so brilliant and clever and beautiful. Although, you're still these things even if this is your favorite game. But we probably have some listeners who feel really strongly about this game. And I don't blame you. I love it. I think it's a superb game. But I do look at it and think, like, this isn't really, like, this is a survival horror game as a game, but in terms of presentation, I wouldn't really call it...
More survival than horror.
Exactly so. I was trying to think of a way to codify that. Because it uses a lot of the visual tropes of horror. You have some body horror going on with crazy mutants that are half man and half, like, scorpion spider thing. And, you know, you have, like, some armor suits that actually have, like people in them, but they're presented in a very spooky, like, living armor way. And, you know, it's kind of funny to note that this game originally, in its prototype form, as originally presented, had straight-up, like, ghosts and shit in it. Like, it was going to be a horror game. But for whatever reason, the direction Capcom took it in was more of, like, a bro shooter action game that really took the gameplay tenets of survival horror and less of the horrific pacing and storytelling, atmospheric sort of codifiers.
Well, I mean, then look what happened with 5 and 6. I know it might be jumping ahead of you, unless this is where you were wanting
to go. Well, it was. I was going to say, because 5 and 6, and we talked about it on the show somewhat recently. I don't remember
in
what capacity.
With the HD remaster of the... What's the one for 3DS that was really good?
Revelations.
Revelations that... You know,
the return to horror.
Yeah. And it's because they just went, hey, bro.
Yeah, let's go to Uganda and shoot some zombies,
bro. And was 5
bro.
The one with the opt-in multiplayer? That
5 people, and 6 both had multiplayer.
They didn't. I know people did not like that.
And 5, it's worse, although it does have a really cool woman of color protagonist if you're playing co-op. A woman named Sheva, and she's really cool. Sheva, maybe. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. It's been several years. But I actually thought it was all right. All bro dude moments aside, Chris Redfield punching a boulder into lava and all this bullshit. But, yeah, so still...
I just can't imagine a survival horror game with two people playing it being very suspenseful.
Well, it's not. It's not suspenseful. There is some amount of tension and discomfort in a horrific sense generated by watching your partner get attacked while you're in a position not to help them.
Mm.
Like, oh, dude, that monster is coming at my player friend with a effing chainsaw, and I am here laying prostrate under a zombie trying to get up from up from under him. I'm not going to be able to help my friend in time. That's a tense experience, but it's not horror in the sense of, like, hanging dragon
and pending
doom. I almost
have to wonder if, for Dead Rising Case West, if that's one of the reasons why that's probably the most humorous entry in Dead Rising. I'm getting a little off track here, but because, you know, you can't help out your friend, and, you know, so they just maybe just decided to add more levity that way. But yeah. Anyways, Resident Evil.
Well, I'm going to say to me, and I'm going to go off with this, that the reason why we chose to represent Resident Evil as a series... with a discussion of Resident Evil 4 here, is because Resident Evil 4, from a gameplay perspective, to me, that's where the entire survival horror style of game, to me, that's sort of the apex of it as currently exists. You know, we talked about how this was a Shinji Mikami game, and we also mentioned earlier about how Shinji Mikami is working now on the psychological horror game The Evil Within, also known in Japan as Psycho Break. I can't help but wonder if he's not going to take some of these gameplay tenets that he pioneered here and really purified in Resident Evil 4 and present them with a more consistent and atmospheric presentation in The Evil Within. This is my hope, certainly.
I think it looks promising.
So... obviously, I'm not going to talk about other games in the Resident Evil series. There are way too many to possibly discuss.
It's not Resident Evil, baby.
It's not, although we could do a Resident Evil episode. Maybe next Halloween. Give us a year to play through that whole pile of crap. No, I actually really like Code Veronica for the Dreamcast. So, that's the one with the psychic twins.
Oh, did Code Veronica, didn't it get an HD remaster?
It did. And I believe it actually released on the same day as the Resident Evil 4 HD remaster.
I think it's on PS Plus, actually.
I think so.
I think it may have been. Grabbed it, yeah.
I want to talk now about another pinnacle of its respective series. And this is controversial opinion buoy here, because this is a series...
Oh, you know what I've been doing all episode?
All right. This is a series that is well-loved by many people, including quite a few of our Game Buoy listeners. Oh, God, my voice. One moment. Many of our listeners really quite like this series, and this game within this series is not particularly well-loved. I want to talk to you about Silent Hill Shattered Memories. And Slagkick, this is one that I understand you to have a fair amount of experience with, so why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I mean... This was actually my first Silent Hill because, you know, I never really, at the time, contemporaneously had much interest in the Silent Hill games just because, you know, like, I didn't have the, you know, I didn't have friends who played them, so, you know, I didn't have the, interest generated for it, but, you know, my understanding of every other Silent Hill game before it is, you know, got your guns and you're, you know, shooting stuff, and I thought what was really interesting about Shattered Memories was that it was not a combat based game at all, and it was, you know, you had to shake off the what were they called? The zombie nightmare things.
I haven't played this game in since probably 2009. I couldn't tell you.
But, you know, you had to shake them off, and there was some fun, you know, I say waggle, but I don't mean it in a derogatory way.
Okay, we'll use the term waggle here on out, but we are not bashing motion control.
But, you know, so
because
some...
it would be lame to focus a whole segment on bashing motion control.
No, but I actually think that the motion control was an interesting element of it, you know, like, depending on which way the monsters were grabbing you, you know, you might have to, like, fling them up off you or fling them to the side. And, but I mean, that game... I think one of the strengths of it and what really feels very survival horror-ish about it is, you know, the atmosphere of it, like Captain Spike was saying, is important for the motif of horror.
And, you know, I want to say, this game is often codified as a survival horror game. I would call this personally a psychological horror game. Because, again, you know, survival is an element. You are trying to survive. You're not fight or flighting. You are just flighting. And that is terrifying.
I would compare it more to, like, an Uninvited. You know, your goal is to, you know, be exploring around. You have your flashlight. You have your cell phone. And you can take pictures on your cell phone, which reminded me a lot of the last game that we're going to be talking about. But, you know, it's more about puzzle solving, exploration. And then if you're waiting around too long, oh, yes, you're going to get attacked and killed.
You know, we haven't talked a lot about the use of music in creating atmosphere.
Well, I was just going to get to that, but why don't you take us there?
Brilliant. You know, because a lot of the games that we've discussed so far here do not have super noteworthy music. I would say that one of the hallmarks of Silent Hill is, especially the most of the core games in the series, you know, not some of the more recent Western-developed sequels and spin-offs, but the original core games all had music by video game music superstar Akira Yamaoka. And his soundtrack for Shattered Memories, to me in particular, is extremely effective because it actually has dynamically changing music. So, you know, songs will segue into one another. Some of them will have additional elements based on what's happening on screen to you to sort of heighten the atmosphere. And to me, it creates this additional layer on which, you know, tension and atmosphere is
very
being built.
Spooky, ambient, sort of, you know, which I think really, like you said, creates the suspense and the tension. And, like, you know, there was a little bit of that in something like Resident Evil 4, but it just did not have the same effect to me as it did in Shattered Memories. I was playing this game with the lights off, and I was like, ooh,
only
girl,
way to
I'm
fly.
Scared.
Yeah, no, I actually find Silent Hill Shattered Memories, even still, I actually find it quite scary. I think it's quite effective. And, you know, something else I really want to talk about this game is that it has this one really ahead-of-its-time feature that I just think is incredible. You know, it has a framing device that it uses where you're being interviewed by a psychologist, and, you know, you, like, will have to use
yes.
the remote to, like, nod your head yes or shake it no. What it does, what the game does, based on this, and also based on some really weird tricks, like, you know, you're using the Wiimote as your flashlight and looking for things in dark areas in the gameplay. Something that this game does is that it tracks how you play and how you answer these questions in the psychological profiling segments, and it procedurally changes the game in subtle ways around you. So certain sequences will happen with different characters, or characters will be wearing different clothing to sort of reflect the way the game is interpreting your actions and answers. So, like, if you're answering as, like, a very risky, loose, out-of-control person, then maybe when the femme fatale enters the story, maybe she's going to be dressed more salacious.
Seductive.
That's the word I was looking for. And to me, like, it just adds this whole layer of almost mindfuckery to have, pardon my French, to have this sort of really dynamic experience, this horrific experience forming around you that feels, even in these very subtle ways, sort of personalized to what the game thinks will make you most uncomfortable.
And I mean, I see what you mean about, you know, it being more of a psychological horror game, because, I mean, it's tapping in to, you know, your, you know, I guess, human nature to want to, like, protect your daughter as a character. I mean, not to spoil, but, I mean, that was the general premise of the first Silent Hill, right?
Well, you know, and that's part, I think, of why this game is so unloved. It was initially packaged as a remake of the first game. And it breaks away from the canon of the first game's story. And a lot of hardcore devotees of this series, and the fans of this series are pretty rabid. You know, I think that really set it off for a lot of them that, like, oh, this breaks the canon. This isn't real. I don't like it. This is not good. But it really, I appreciate that it was initially packaged as a retelling, but it's, to me, more of a reimagining. And I have to be honest, when I look at the tenets of horror and tension and atmosphere and the things that I personally want from a horror game, and that is, you know, playing it and being actually scared, I would say that Silent Hill Shattered Memories, to me, is by far the most effective game in the series at achieving that.
Mm.
And I actually would be okay if this became Silent Hill Shattered Memories Buoy. Just to fill out the information here, this came out originally on the Wii, December 8th, 2009. It did get ports to the PlayStation 2 and the PSP, although my understanding is that both of those versions of the game are missing some of the more interesting technical features of the game.
Yeah, I could see it not being quite as compelling to play on a traditional Sony control scheme.
Well, I tell you, man, you know, I often laugh when people talk about immersion in games, because that's not how I relate to games, really. But I will say, man, playing Shattered Memories with a Wiimote as your flashlight and, like, pushing things off of you,
it really,
like,
feels like
I got really effing into it.
It really feels like an extension of you.
Yeah, it's. I think, to me, it's a real argument of the power of motion controls when used correctly. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying every game is a good fit for motion controls, but...
Heavenly Sword.
Right? But when it works, I think it's...
Arrow.
Lair. I think that when it's implemented correctly, it can have tremendous, tremendous atmospheric additions to the game. I think that it has real benefits. That's the word I was looking for. And I cannot recommend Silent Hill Shattered Memories enough. If you're interested in being spooked by a game, look it up right now.
Do you say spooked or spooped?
I said spooked, but spooped would have worked.
Ah.
Let's move on to the last game we're going to look at. We're on a time limit here. I really want to be done in the next 18 minutes. So let's try to get this show on the road. Slagkick, why don't you tell me, because I know you've had some game play experience with this one, why don't you tell me about the first Fatal Frame?
Do you want me to give the general premise of it?
Yeah, sure, as much as you can say.
You're a girl who takes pictures of ghosties. Well, but one thing that Fatal Frame also does very well is in similar ways that Silent Hill Shattered Memories later did, but and also, you know, I would argue also different ways. It's very cinematic in a lot of ways. You know, the whole prologue is done like black and white, very grainy, and, you know, I think that definitely affects the atmosphere. But also, you know, the soundtrack is very suspenseful, and I again was playing with the lights off, and, you know, I was starting to get a little creeped out. And one of the things that I thought really was effective was the way that, depending on where you were walking around this, because you're in a mansion, I won't give too much spoilers, but, you know, you're taking pictures of ghosts, but depending on where you're walking, you know, the camera angle will change, and so, you know, you're supposed to be taking pictures of these ghosts, but, like, you know, you might see a flash of a ghost, and then, like, you look again, and they're gone. So, I mean, it's very... I think out of all the games we've talked about, I think it was the scariest for me. Just because there's these elements of, you know, just... There was one point when I was walking through a hallway very early on, and, like, there were some fucking... Pardon my French, but there were some fucking, like, ghost hands coming down from the ceiling. I mean, it was very unnerving, and I think just, you know, also very interesting, similar to Shattered Memories, although this predated it, that it's not combat-based, it's...
On that note, I just want to remark that Fatal Frame came out originally on the PlayStation 2 in 2001 and 2002 in Japan and North America, respectively. It got a superb Xbox... One original Xbox port in 2002, November, so sort of at the end of that year. and it is presently available on PSN for PS3 as a PS2 classic.
Yes.
Please continue.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, you know, it's not combat-based. I mean, well, it is, but your combat is by taking pictures and, you know, it's like draining the soul energy from the ghosts. So, I mean, on a superficial way, you could think of it as the Poltergeist. But, I mean, it's really, like, you know, I would not say that Luigi's Mansion is a horror game. Luigi's Mansion is maybe a little more of a horror game than Resident Evil 4 is. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, I mean, Fatal Frame truly is horror to me because, you know, it's one thing to have, like, spooky girl theming, like a Luigi's Mansion with, like, ooh, ghosts in a mansion. But, I mean, just the suspense and, you know, and like I said, I think the camera angles changing depending on, like, which way you're walking, and it just makes it very cinematic and adds another layer of suspense that I don't think quite happens when you have, you know, a player-controlled camera, like, constantly, you know. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. In fact, I think that Fatal Frame is supremely effective for pretty much all the reasons you just listed. It's sort of awkward because you said a lot of the things I was going to say. I do want to remark, you know, a lot of these horror games that we talk about, they come from a Western style of storytelling. We discussed this a little bit earlier. Even the Resident Evil series, I felt like, got away from sort of the quirky perspective Eastern style of storytelling when they went more bro dude punching boulders.
Well, wasn't Silent Hill designed, the original Silent Hill was designed to appeal to Western gamers?
Well, yes, that is my understanding. And they worked with a Western studio to make Shattered Memories, which, you know, this sort of inbuilt xenophobia might almost be a part of why that game is so frowned upon by its community, because that is a community of gamers that do really appreciate their games being, pardon the expression, I don't mean this in a racist way, I just can't think of a better way to describe it. These are people who do prefer their games to be Japanese-y. These Bimani
kids. I knew you were
going
to take it to an easy breezy.
I still remember the ways that you touched me. I effing love that first English Utada record.
I love both of them. So
no,
anyway,
I do. I actually love both.
We're not Utada Buoy, so let's move on.
Wouldn't that be great, Utada Buoy?
Utada Buoy.
Your twice monthly port of call for all the Utada news and views that aren't on your radar, but still should be.
She's on hiatus, so that's not going to work.
It's a 5-second episode every week. It's just us still on hiatus. And then we just hum a different Utada song and we're done. But, you know, Fatal Frame in particular, I mean, I want to bring up the Eastern and Western storytelling philosophy differences in the context to simply say that while most of these games feel like you're in an American horror movie, like you're in a Texas Chainsaw, or you're in a Nightmare on Elm Street, or you're in a Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Fatal Frame feels more like you're in an Eastern, like a Japanese horror film. This feels more like you're in a movie adjacent to The Ring or The Grudge.
Yeah.
And to me, it's just a different flavor. It has a lot of lore, really interesting story that it's telling. And it's just a really captivating experience. I love that it connected so well for you, Slagkick, because I think that it's a really incredible experience. And it is. It's like Pokemon Snap gone spoopy. Pokemon Spoop. So
Pokemon Snap with all haunters.
Right? Exactly. Hunters. I think it's a stupendous game. If you have the means to play it in this day and age, I think that you could do a heck of a lot worse than that. So there were a series of sequels released on the PlayStation 2, also available on PlayStation 3 via PSN as PS2 classics. There were three, 1, 2, and 3. And there was also a fourth game that was Wii exclusive that used the Wiimote in some really interesting ways.
Wow.
At some point, I want to do an episode just on games that are import only. That have translation patches, because there is a translation patch for the U.S. version, or the U.S., for the European, gosh darn. There are translation patches for the Japanese release of Fatal Frame 4, and it's a great game. I highly recommend people play it. There was also a Wii remake of Fatal Frame 2 released in Europe and Japan. So those are also things worth looking into.
Oh, neat.
But I would start with the easiest spot. If you have a PS3, download Fatal Frame, play it on Halloween night, and let yourself be spooked out.
Well, I before we move on, you probably want to mention spin-off.
There was a spin-off using the augmented reality camera style gameplay that you saw on the 3DS launch titles. Obviously, this is for the 3DS also, called Spirit Camera.
Which I believe we've talked about on air.
I believe we have, so I won't talk about it, really. But it's, you know, it exists in this canon, in this universe, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. With that, unless you have anything else to say about horror games, let's see if we can finish this episode in the next 10 minutes.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, usually on these, like, overview episodes, we try to wrap it up with, like, you know, a look at the future. But since we're not really doing a historical perspective...
Yeah.
Then, you know, I think that's best saved for another time.
We will have to, because I do have a lot of strong feelings on what I'd like to see from horror games in the future.
Well, my understanding is that Koopa Club is doing an episode on horror gaming.
Oh, that's awesome!
And they're going to be looking at it from a historical perspective. I hope I just didn't give spoilers away. Oops.
Oh, well, excellent. Well, this was a happy accident, then.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'll be very interested, and I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot from their perspective of that.
Yeah, check them out over at...
KoopaClub.com.
That's Koopa with the Q, Club with the K. We love those guys. We really appreciate what they do. And they're probably going to do the whole horror games thing way better than us. So please check them out. And then we'll do our inferior version sometime down the line. And they can point and laugh.
All right.
Let's get on to some other segments. We have a Smash or Trash today. Smash or Trash! We're going to take this real quick because our Smash and our Trash are basically the same thing. At the end of the generation that we're currently in, you know, the Wii, the PS3, and the Xbox 360, Kotaku is running a series of articles. You can find them under the tags Last Gen Heroes and Last Gen Zeros. And these are basically all articles about things from Last Gen that they either really did like or really didn't like. The Smash is the Heroes tag. I think this is a great idea. I love the idea of looking at sort of retrospectively at the end of the generation and saying, this is what was awesome, this is what we loved, this is what absolutely hit. And some of the stuff here was talking about like how the trend of console games getting ports to PC finally, talking about how all games this generation have had RPG elements, and for a lot of gamers, these are great things. About how, you know, two non-Final Fantasy games this generation, talking about Lost Odyssey and Last Story specifically, are like the best JRPGs of the generation. They're not Final Fantasy games. Like, who would have thought that could happen in the past? Hell, one of them's a Wii U exclusive,
Yeah.
The Last Story. So, just, to me, really great conversations happening over on Kotaku, which not a phrase I ever thought I'd say. But I have
because
to give credit where it's due.
Trash.
That having been said, the trash is also Kotaku. Last Gen Zeros,
that's
to
something
me,
we've said a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's true. You know, when they're on, I actually got to give them a lot of credit. I think they're super on. But when they're off, I basically think they're a scourge on games journalism. Look, I don't need an article from you in 2013 bashing the Xbox 360's HD DVD drive. And talking about how it was like a big deal and super negative on them. No, they tried something. It didn't work. Move the F on. I don't need an article from you called Motion Controls the Most Popular and Broken Idea Gaming Ever Had. No, because you know what? I'm sorry. I think it's awesome that Nintendo used motion control to the degree that they did and really tried this new cool thing to make it
work.
It's
not their fault that third-party developers didn't think of out-of-the-box ways to implement
it. Well, exactly. That's my problem. I look at a tag like Last Gen Zeros, and I just hear ways that companies legitimately tried to move the games industry forward that failed. And okay, like, I guess what you do, you're, you know, hit-grabbing sensationalistic headlines, I guess in that economy of word budget or what have you, like, it makes sense to run stories like this. But honestly, yeah, man,
but then you're just encouraging the mindless sheep out there, which are not our beautiful, wonderful, talented, amazing listeners.
I'm actually going to bristle at calling anyone sheep. I think that a lot of gamers, if you have mature conversations with them about games, I think a lot of them would really appreciate it. They just don't know where that content is, and Kotaku's
true.
What
there,
comes
there
up
are
if you
also
Google
people,
gaming?
I'm gaming sure news. There are also some people who would take Kotaku as like basically the Bible.
There are. Oh, I'm sure there are. I just don't want to say anything negative about even those people.
Yeah, I suppose you've got a better heart than I do. But I'm just saying that there's no need to encourage negativity in the discussion of gaming when you could be doing it from a more constructive way. So, shall we move on to...
I said, hey! What's going on?
I said, away, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, stop singing.
Talk. I said, hey.
Tell me what you've been playing.
What's going on?
So this week I've been playing Pokemon X. I have been playing Disgaea D2, and I played about 5 minutes of Wind Waker HD.
I hear that disdain in your voice.
No, it was actually really quite good. Wind Waker was beautiful, really just stupendous. Mm-hmm. I still don't know if I like it more than I like Wind Waker running on Dolphin with all of the, like, right. widescreen hack implemented and, like, high-resolution textures for the on-screen graphical user interface.
Right.
But it is a real treat. Some of the changes they made are stupendous.
Mm-hmm.
I say that I played for 5 minutes, but I got far enough in that I have the King of Red Lions.
Right.
And I have, you know, the boat and stuff, so... You know, I played it, and I loved it. I made it through that stealth sequence without getting caught a single time. I still remembered it from last time.
I got caught once.
Oh, man.
And I mean, I'm going to kind of overlap with you on my WhatsApps this week because,
Did you play Disgaea D2?
No, I didn't. But otherwise, we overlap. And for Wind Waker HD, you know, it's been a while since I played, so I realized, oh, I don't remember every puzzle, which is... Which is great, because, you know, Ocarina, I could probably remember how to do every puzzle and everything, but it's like, you know, discovering a lot of it again, so that's great. And I think it looks beautiful. I guested on an episode of Koopa Club recently, in which we talked about Wind Waker HD in depth, so we will shout them out later, but over at Koopa
Club. You know, I actually listened to that. It was great. You know, obviously I love what those guys do. Those guys mean a lot to me. I think they're really cool. But that was a stupendous episode talking about just Zelda for a whole episode.
Just Wind Waker HD, primarily, yeah.
So it was really cool. It actually, that's a big part of why I finally started playing my copy.
Oh, well, I'm glad.
So credit to you guys. Credit to them, certainly. And also well done to you. I was really proud of how you represented our ship.
Thank you. Unlike on some shows that I appear on where I'm foul.
Disgaea D2 is the same as it ever was for the Disgaea series. Lots of numbers, hardcore making a spreadsheet for how I'm growing all my units. Except also, all the sprites are finally redrawn at HD resolution, so it's super effing pretty.
Yay.
And last, but most certainly not least, Pokemon X.
Pokemon X and Y.
We're going to do a whole Pokemon episode. This is a real thing. I'm not going to talk about this game too much right now, because we're going to talk about it. Like next month, I think.
Do you want to just talk about where you're at gameplay wise?
I'm just about to fight the Elite Four. I'm like
That's
literally
awesome.
Like 1 or 2 minutes away. Like I just have to heal my Pokemans and then talk to the Elite Four.
I am on my way to the final gym, so I'm not too far behind you.
No, you're not.
But one thing that I noticed is that, and I mean, I can't blame them, but a lot of people I know finished the game really fast. I mean, they just devoured it, and I mean, I don't blame them, but. Captain Spike and I have kind of been a little bit, you know, taking our time. It's been out for a couple of weeks now, and so, you know, I feel, you know, part of it's because of IRL, but also, you know, it's been nice to, you know, just take it a little bit at a time and play with my Pokemans, and yeah, like he said, we're going to talk about the series in depth very soon, so please look forward to it. With that, may I move on to our social links? I'll breeze through these.
Yep, you sure as hell can.
All right, well, I would like to start with our question of the week, which was, this week we're talking about horror games. from Alan Wake to Uninvited. Do you have a favorite spooky game? The Facebook bonus question was, horror games come in many forms, though of late it seems to be all about survival horror.
It's this venture where I'm just going to say real quick, if you don't check us out on Facebook, you definitely should, especially if you like interacting with us in these questions of the week, because we do add an additional sort of sub-question to the question of the
yes.
week, because we have the additional space,
mm-hmm.
You know, to have more than just 140 characters.
Yes.
Go.
So, horror games come in many forms, though of late it seems to be all about survival horror. But what's your favorite? So, I'll start with the Twitter responses. We got a lot of great tweets in response to that. Twitter user NS Broom said, I hate scary games, but I always watch them out of some sick curiosity, so I'd say Silent Hill 2. Atari Barbie, also known as Ian from Koopa Club, said, it'll always be the Silent Hill series for me, mainly for Akira Yamaoka's brilliance. He and Trent Reznor should score a Silent Hill. I would be here for that.
I'd be in, yeah.
The boys over at VG Realness tweeted the Resident Evil remake for GameCube. Spider Boss, I screamed and turned off the system. I'm not sure which VG
yeah.
Realness boy.
I think
this was.
Delvin answers does the main, the
okay.
main Twitter.
Because JLAWL over on Twitter is also from VG Realness.
Y'all boys are so cute. Thank you.
Said Silent Hill 3, so many moments it's hard to begin. Twitter
yes.
user LeopardChan5, better known as...
Also, can we just talk about the main theme from Silent Hill for a minute, though? Throwing it out there.
LeopardChan5, also known as Seawolf Jason, says, the rescue of Pops Ghostly, which is for the
That was
Action
an Action
Max
game. You know, the crazy thing about the Action Max is that it was a light gun game system that literally just used... VHS tapes and some ridiculous technology that to this day I don't really understand to be like a full-fledged, like, live-action video game console. Like, you would shoot things on screen and they would break and fall apart
and
stuff.
We should talk about the Action Max one day.
I have one. I have one in the closet behind
you.
Oh,
dear. We're going to have
I have Pops Ghostly on tape. I have one Wild West tape. And I have one, like, submarine ship escape tape.
We are going to have to do a... obscure retro hardware episode one day.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, this was actually a bonding moment for Seawolf Jason and I. You know, I've known that guy like 20 years. I was the best man at his wedding. Incredible fellow. He's been here on the show with us to talk about fighting games. And one of our shared early experiences was that we were the only two dudes that either of us knew that knew what the hell an Action Max was, much less... the rescue of Pops Ghostly. So, thank you for bringing that up, Jason. I know you're trying to be a troll, but actually, even though that game's not terrifying in any way, it would be a great discussion point for GameBuoy at some point.
Before I move on to our Facebooks, we got a Google Plus. It's from Colin M, who is from the Nerd Podcast. That's G-N-E-R-D, silent G, which I haven't had a chance to check out, but we will shout him out.
No, but you sure checked him out.
Girl... so we'll definitely shout him out, and I look forward to hearing the podcast. So Colin said that spooky games are stressful, which is why I never finished them. Me too. But Eternal Darkness and Alone in the Dark for 360 come to mind. Oh, and Left 4 Dead 2. All right, I'll really quickly get through these Facebook answers. Francisco Yu said that Resident Evil 2 and Silent Hill 2 scared the crap out of me. I couldn't play RE2 for long because I was really frightened from the opening FMV and had nightmares afterwards. Aw. Silent Hill 2, I forced myself to keep playing because, holy crap, it was a good kind of scare. What can I say? I'm a big baby when it comes to scary things. Me too. Jeremy from Koopa Club said, Uninvited, a favorite of mine. The soundtrack is exceptional. I love how brutal it is for an NES game. And he said, I kind of hope that psychological horror comes back into fashion. Colin M. also commented over on Facebook, saying, I forgot about Uninvited. There's a game I need to revisit in the near future. I love the Deja Vu Shadowgate games. Wouldn't mind seeing more horror adventure point-and-click games. Horror action makes me more stressed than scared. And Ian from Koopa Club... sorry, I'm blanking out here. Ian from Koopa Club also commented over on Facebook and said... he'd really like to see, for our bonus question, a horror music game. He says when he plays horror games, ambience is important for... or ambiance is important for him. The OG Silent Hills captured this, and he loved the work on Dead Space. But he loved to see the play on sound in a sort of quasi-witness-mist sort of world, relying on a choose-your-own-adventure.
You know, I just want to say, if you haven't played Mansion of Hidden Souls, or to some degree, like Seventh Guest, maybe, these things might be up your alley, Ian. Also, if you haven't played Silent Hill Shattered Memories, you mentioned in one of your tweets liking that Akira Yamaoka music. I think you would get a lot out of Shattered Memories if you haven't played it.
And Renee from, thank you. Renee from Koopa Club said he seconds that emotion for Uninvited, but also for Shadowgate. Both of them were really suspenseful and had you second guessing yourself if you took the right course of action. And he said, and please, for the love of Bidoof, no more jump scares.
Bidoof, Bidoof. Bidoof, Bidoof. 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 Bidoof, Bidoof. Bidoof.
Okay, Bidoof, Bidoof. You're getting as bad as Renee here with the Bidoofs. You were the OG Bidoof fan, by the way. We might have to mention that on the Pokemon episode.
I'm a Bidoof fan, thanks.
So really quickly, I want to
My first Bidoof was named Bidoof. Sorry, continue.
I just really quickly, because we need to wrap this up.
Wrap it up.
I want to just share some general feedback we got. Twitter user Steve Pixels said he really enjoyed the episode we did with the Castlevania retrospective. So thank you so much, Steve Pixel.
Thank you, Steve Pixel. We appreciate that.
And the book pirate over on Twitter, who is Colin M. from the Nerd podcast, said that he just finished the most recent episode and looks forward to checking out older episodes. Because he said, a pirate-themed gay video game podcast? Oddly specific, but oddly perfect for me. Super, super hearts.
That is something that you and I have in common, my friend. So I'm simply delighted that you enjoyed us.
And we had a Game Buoy Extra from Jeremy from Koopa Club. He said, hashtag Game Buoy Extra, the Journey Special Edition for PS3 has commentary for Flow, Flower, and Journey. Flower's commentary was very interesting. I love those games. I didn't realize that there was commentary on them, so I need to go back.
But he's talking about the on-disc version they sold.
It might not be in the download version. I have the on-disc version.
Oh, snipple snaps.
Yeah. So, we love your feedback. We love your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews.
Please subscribe to us and review us. No.
Do you like your Facebook
no
likes?
No one has.
We fucking love Twitter. Actually, we have one rating.
I know that Jeremy gave us an awesome one.
That made me feel happy. We like your Facebook likes. We fucking love Twitter. You can find us on Tumblr, Google Plus. You can email us at
mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
Let's give some shout outs to some people.
Please check out gamebuoy.org. You can find links to all of these different social feeds. You can find me on Twitter personally at @spikepoint.
I'm at @psychic.
Exactly. So,
let's get these shout-outs
I want to quickly shout out to Koopa Club, as I've said like 15 times today, man. They're great. I love what they do. Look at them like sisters. If you like our show, it's very likely that you'll also like their show. Same thing on that for VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends. Both Koopa Club and VG Realness are LGBT-focused. Obviously, we are here on Game Buoy as well, but, you know, it still bears mention. Also, Geek Charisma, a podcast that is everything geek with discussion on movies, DVDs, video games, conventions, and comics. I also want to talk about Neshoba Talks With You About Games. What Neshoba is doing over there is unlike anything else. It's basically NPR, about video games meets Broadway. It's like on Broadway NPR. They sing and dance and steal things. I don't know. It's superb.
And
that was a Jason Mraz reference. I feel so dirty.
Oh, dear.
And also, of course, want to shout out Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. Hopefully, Rob Roberts over there is going to be very pleased that I didn't call him old a single time this episode.
You just did. Oops.
No, I didn't. I said I didn't. Your turn. Shoot.
Go ahead and sing.
We want to take you to a game bar!
Game Bar, the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary, the Gay Video Game Prairie Home Companion. There's the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest shock jock video game radio show that you'll ever come across. It's a bag of hot dicks. We just had an appearance on there. It's very R-rated, so if that's your bag, go check it out. It's that their bag of hot dicks. Over on the Vogue...
We guessed it on that.
Yeah. Over on the VOG network, there's Horde House, a place for all things online gaming, but never too seriously, and Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. There's Video Game Outsiders, the podcast about video gaming from the average player's perspective. And like I said, there's the Nerd Podcast, that's G-N-E-R-D, silent G, and I look forward to listening to them. They are pop culture rants from a gay nerd perspective, so definitely can't wait to check them out, and we appreciate their support for us. We love you all.
Indeed, we sure do. I have one last minute shout-out.
Oh, you do?
This is for the Game Over Takeover podcast being done by Wicked over at
Nerdgasm Network.
At Nerdgasm Network, as well as with Sin, also from Nerdgasm Network, and someone named Ark, with whom I'm not terribly familiar.
He's an occasional contributor to Nerdgasm as well.
Excellent. They have a new show. They recorded their first episode tonight. My understanding is that they're going to have it up on their feed, on a feed of some kind, on Monday. So probably by the time our listeners are hearing this episode.
That's really awesome.
We'll provide a link for you. My understanding is that they are primarily video game focused, but also discussing tabletop and card-based games.
That's cool, because I mean, I know the Nerdgasm Network video game podcast is video game-centric, and the thing that's also kind of cool about Nerdgasm is it's got a lot of different people who are on other shows. So I'm really glad to see that John's, you know...
Wicked.
I'm really glad to see... they call him John on air, though.
I'm not going to edit this out. Just keep going.
You know, I'm glad to see because, you know, Wicked podcasting kind of led us into podcasting.
Yeah, no,
so.
He literally, if not for him, this show wouldn't exist. Him and Rob Roberts in large part.
Yeah.
So thank you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, listeners. Yeah, thank you for being with us here tonight. Thank you for listening to our show. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Please give us your feedback. We live for it. You know, until next time, keep gaming, keep thinking, and Ochita Okami. Penises.
I'm your penis.
Testicles. Keep on.
Oh, I did. Testicles, testicles, testicles.
You're recording while you're playing back?
Yeah.
Oh. I'm your penis. I'm your vagina. Your desire.
And slag kick, just so that you're aware, I'm going to take a couple of these news stories we have and smash them into one here. Obviously.
Oh, girl.
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 Don't do that. That's no fuck with your voice.
Do you want to just start over from this follow-up? Big Dick Bottoms.
Ooh, girl.
Ooh, you know you're all into that sexual paradigm shift.
Oh, we don't have to say. But first, a side note. Yes, blah, 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 blah.
Why would we?
No, just it seems like that we've had a lot of those lately. Oh, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, blah, 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 blah.
All right, let's do it.
Bitch, cut me off.
Yeah, dude, perfect.
What was that look? Like, you look really bummed out right now, dude.
My name's Susan, and I'm addicted to drinking my own urine.
I didn't know that about you.
I wear my dad's dirty socks. Sniff, sniff, sniff.
Oh, look, there's two Super Mario games, and then there's the Mario game. Mario is a cat.